It's time for Mac Break Weekly. Renee Ritchie's here. Andy Nocco's here. Alex Lindsay's in studio. We'll talk about Apple's quarterly results. I know it was last week, but there's a lot to say about that. Rumors about the next generation iWatch and what we are going to see in the cameras in the next iPhone. It's going to blow your mind. Plus, why Justin Trudeau is peeking out from my chest. It's all coming up next on Mac Break Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Mac Break Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 570, recorded Tuesday, August 8th, 2017. Bare-chested Justin. MacBreak Weekly is brought to you by WordPress. Your customers want to find you. So build a WordPress.com website and help them connect with your business. Get 15% off any new plan purchase at WordPress.com/MacBreak. And by Dollar Shave Club. For a great shave at a great price, join Dollar Shave Club. New members get their first month of the Executive Razor and a tube of Dr. Carver's Shave Butter for only $5 with free shipping. Get yours at dollarshaveclub.com/MacBreak. And by Texture. Access the world's most popular magazines anytime, anywhere, using your smartphone or tablet. Try it free for 14 days at texture.com/twit. It's time for MacBreak Weekly, the show where we talk about the latest news from Apple. Look, lo and behold, in studio, I can touch him and somebody said we got to get a box to put around you so that you look like you're here. It's Alex Lindsay. He is here from PixelCore, all the way from San Rafael. Did you ride the train, the new light rail?
No, I haven't. It's not
set up yet.
It's not really running yet.
No. Someday you'll be able to do that.
Instead, I just had to ride the Narrows.
Yeah, that's the worst. Well, that's a local problem. we won't bore people with that. Back from his trip to New York City, Renee Ritchie is here. He was down there writing about iOS 11 and photography.
Yes, sir. And I also want to point out that Alex's lip sync is perfect today.
Isn't that interesting? How did we do that?
Oh, man.
We worked on that one.
Dang.
Is your article up on imore.com?
Yes, it is. I'll put it in the show notes.
Because I really am very interested in that. Because one of the things I'm thinking about is instead of bringing a laptop on my next trip, bringing an iPad with iOS 11 on it. The 10.5 Mac.
Yeah.
Can I do it?
The only thing you can't do is a portrait mode.
I don't care. I want to bring a camera.
Yeah.
I'm going to bring a camera, although having a nice camera on the iPad. Yeah. But I'm thinking for all the post and selection and triage and all that stuff.
And I really haven't used Lightroom on the iPad.
It's pretty good.
Do you like it?
Yeah, I'll talk about that in a second.
The interface is weird, but it's good.
He's the guy to ask. Also with us, another guy who is an avid photographer and Mac aficionado. Mr. Andy Nocco from the Chicago.
All I care about is that you pronounce my name right. That's all I care. All the other words don't matter.
I have no idea how to spell it, but I do know how to pronounce it. Nocco. Ladies and gentlemen, right after the show last week, they do it every time. Apple announced its results. And a bit of a surprise. Renee, because you were on assignment, were you able to listen to the call anyway and do your traditional?
I listened to it while walking the streets of New York City, and Serenity Caldwell is away defending the honor of Canada in the roller derby world championships or something in Europe.
Congratulations.
And just defeating, her team is doing great, so fingers crossed. So we had Lori Gill, Micah Sargent, and Joe Keller stepping in for us, and they did a phenomenal job.
So there were surprises, right? Apple did better in this quarter, its third fiscal quarter, than it normally does. This is usually the slow quarter, right?
Yeah, I'm getting to that age, Leo. I don't know if it's just me being disgruntled by all this stuff. But a lot of it is just math. It's like how many weeks are in the month? What happened last year and the year-to-year compares? Was there a surplus? Was there a shortage? Did people upgrade early? Did they upgrade late? And everyone is breathless about these things. But then when you go after the call or 2 or 3 hours after the call, it's like, oh, this is why all that happened.
Yeah.
They're making more money than anybody. Yeah. It just keeps happening.
Yeah. Well, you see how spiky their revenue is in this graph from Mac Rumors. It's really in the last few years, it's all been all about iPhones, and it's highly predictable. The big spikes, though, and notice they're up every single, you know, fourth quarter. Those are the fourth quarter spikes, and it's because of the iPhone sales. Now, there's somebody, some people have been saying that Apple's going to try to move iPhone sales out of the, because they usually only get a week or two in the last quarter of iPhone sales, move it all fully into the first quarter by delaying the release of the next iPhones till October. You think that's reasonable?
I don't think they do that for Wall Street. I mean, there's a myriad of reasons they might have to do that, but they've been doing this for years, and I think that idea probably occurred to Tim Cook, second 0.01.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, they're not dumb. Apple's at an all-time high as we begin the show. The chat room's telling me $161.10, which is kind of remarkable. Does that put them in the trillion-dollar, to the trillion-dollar?
Not yet.
They're getting close.
Yeah, they're getting there.
So, and I agree with you, Renee. Thinking in quarters is really not, this is one of the problems in America is that businesses are kind of by the markets required to think in terms of quarterly results, when that isn't really how you should be thinking of it.
And growth, I mean, if Apple makes a gazillion dollars and they don't make a gazillion point two next year, even if they make a gazillion point one, it doesn't matter. We don't want money. We want the possibility of future money we don't actually have yet.
Big news.
Yeah, also it feels a little bit less important because with other companies, a bad quarter means that a CEO is no longer CEO. Mm-hmm. Apple, they have to have a lot of bad quarters before they have to answer to anybody but God. Even God would be like, I'm gonna hang with you for another 3 years just in case you do wind up with that 3D sensing phone. But until then.
Yeah, why wouldn't you, really, if you
got an
Apple upgrade
coming?
The stock went up quite a bit, of course, after the results were announced. And you know, the reason it's high is it's staying high. Let me get some more of these charts here. The current at this current market cap is $832 billion. So they still got a way to go if you're going to hit.
The fun part for me, and I don't know if I'm jumping too far ahead here, is when they gave the projections for next quarter, everyone just stopped and said, wait a minute, those projections seem to include new iPhone sales, which usually is a no-brainer, but there was so many rumors about delays and they couldn't do it, and it'd be pushed out to this quarter or that quarter or this year, and it turns out maybe not so much.
Boy, if you bought Apple stock 1 year ago, you would have seen a $50 a share increase over the last year alone.
And this is when everyone said that they were in trouble.
Yeah, panic.
Well, okay, but I do want to say that there's a difference between how the stock market does and the long-term future of a company.
Right.
And Apple is absolutely firing on all cylinders right now with the iPhone, but that doesn't mean that in 3 years it's going to look like this. Now,
they were worried about then. Like, they were worried about that quarter. Like, Apple's down. Apple's going to stay down. The stock's never going to bounce back.
No, that's true. Yeah.
Also, it's important just to keep in mind that Apple stock is an Apple product. So you can have a bad performing Apple product, but that doesn't mean that they still aren't going to make lots of money off of the Macs and lots of money off the iPhones and everything else. Right.
Well, and that was one of the good news features of this quarterly report is iPad sales showing some real strength. I think both the new iPad Pros, the 10.5-inch, and the strength of the $329 entry-level iPad showed for the first time in a long time an increase in iPad unit sales.
Am I misremembering? But didn't the ASP suggest that it was the entry-level iPad that was getting a lot of people to turn over?
Yeah. It was mostly the fact that you get a $329 iPad.
Yeah, which prompted all those long in the pocket upgrades.
Unit sales up 28% over the previous quarter, 15% year over year. We haven't seen growth like that in the iPad in a couple of years.
And you don't see that growth like that in most mature markets.
A good point.
You know, it's been out for a long time, so that kind of jump. And I think that maybe some of it was pent up. You know, people didn't really a lot of the iPads didn't. I mean, my kids would use an iPad 2. Or an iPad, you know, or a newer iPad, and they didn't really notice the difference when they're playing Minecraft or doing whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the things we may see, especially as we move forward, is with AR, with some of the other things that are going to push the processors harder, that you may see a larger growth in the iPad because there's going to be apps that are really taking advantage of the chip systems rather than, you know, kind of staying with a vast majority of the apps are not taking full advantage of the hardware. And I think that's what also affects the sales.
Highest global market share in 4 years in markets like China and Japan, Tim Cook said, over half of the iPads are sold to people buying their first iPad. So some of the growth is new markets. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, I think that new iPad Pro combined with iOS 11, I know you're going to talk about that a little bit later, Renee, really is impressive. That is
even
a coming of age for the iPad.
Yeah, and it's the same thing we'll probably talk about with the iPhone later, is that they're attacking the market from multiple fronts. The low-cost iPad appeals to people who have had an iPad 2 and want to upgrade, but also people who have bought crappy video tablets and just have had a terrible experience with them. And I think Tim Cook in previous years has said that they're happy to be someone's second purchase, you know, because every Christmas, Android Central is flooded with people who bought a crappy $50 tablet at whatever big box store or online provider, and it just doesn't work, and they get really upset. And at the price of the new iPad, I think some of them are willing to go a little bit higher just to get something they think will work.
Also big news, and Tim talked a lot about augmented reality, and he pointed out, and this is undeniable, with hundreds of millions of people actively using the iPhone and iPad today, iOS will instantly become the world's biggest augmented reality platform as soon as iOS 11 ships. Is 11 works on better on newer, the presumed new iPhone and the new iPad, but it works still on other older devices?
Yeah, 64-bit.
Okay.
Sorry, Andy.
So, yeah, so the iPhone 5S and newer, I really think the limiting factor for AR is going to be frame rate more than anything else, because once you get the frame rate down, AR starts to break a little bit. At least that's been my experience. So the question, though, going back to something you said a moment ago, is whether there's going to be such a big AR hit like Pokemon Go, that the difference between my iPad will run Pokemon Go, my old iPad, and this other person's iPad will not run Pokemon Go, if that will be the sort of thing that gets people who were maybe open to upgrading for the past couple of years to finally get down the Apple Store with an open wallet.
I think one of the things, we're doing a lot of AR work right now, and one of the things that we've noticed is that, when you really, what's going to start pushing these in a lot of ways is also a polygon count. So right now, we find that the performance gets pretty chunky on a variety of platforms at about 1 to 1.5 million polygons, which is still, I mean, I used to build game models in the 90s when I had to make something in 256 polygons. a million and a half. We barely rendered for the movie I worked on. We barely rendered anything over a million polygons. So the idea that in real time, it's quite a thing.
Yeah. However, more than frame rate or resolution that's going to make or break AR kit. Really good article by a guy named Daniel Eckler, who's been working in augmented reality for many years now, explaining, this is on Medium, it's in the startup on Medium, explaining how the technology of AR, and actually this may not be the article I was thinking of. There's one that talks about the technology, and the real issue with AR is not so much a frame rate, of course that's going to be important, the quality of the image being superimposed on the real world, but the real difficult thing to do, and the thing that demos always overstate, that, you know, because he says don't ever trust an AR YouTube demo because you're seeing only when it worked perfectly,
right,
is that placing that thing in the real world, placing it on tables so it's like it's on a table, placing it so it can move behind things. That's very difficult. All of these things are computationally incredibly difficult to do. And that is going to be the, I think, ultimate test of consumer acceptance, is whether it just looks like Pokemon Go. Just, you know, there's nothing to do there. It's just a thing floating on the street. But if it actually is interacting with the real world.
And this is the stuff that we've
been
challenged.
That's hard.
Yeah. In visual effects, we call this match moving. So match moving is something that,
yes, right,
you know, we're trying to sync somebody in pixels. And the problem really in match moving is that you're either, it's either 100% correct or it's zero because it's sliding, you know, and so it's unacceptable.
Right.
And so you really do get into these situations. And of course you have to decide what the resolution of the tracking needs to be for a given, you know, a given piece, but generally it has to be highly accurate. And especially with AR, it has to be highly accurate. And so those are a mixture of, and those are a mixture of processing the pixels, you know, that are there, but the laser helps a lot because right now the pixels are really good at planes. That's what most of what AR kit that we've seen so far,
right,
is saying, I know where the table is. I know where the floor is. But AR kit right now doesn't have a really good sense of scale. Doesn't have a sense, you know, has a sense of position. Whereas when you look at the Tango platform, you're dealing with something that is actually, you know, can see the space that it's in and make some, right, you know, make some choices.
So that's
about
the point. And this is the article, and I apologize. It's Matt Mieznik's
from Medium, a Super Venture blog, why ARKit is better. And what he does say, in fact, is that Tango and ARKit are very similar. But the reason Tango hasn't taken off, that's the Google solution, is Google doesn't control the hardware platform.
You also can't get it. I mean, yeah. We had that.
Well, that's because it doesn't control the hardware platform. Right.
Our Tango phone came from eBay.
Right. We just ordered the Asus Zenfone AR, which is a Tango phone. So we'll be. This is the first kind of widely available real phone plus Tango.
Yep. And that's the one we have. We got it.
What do you think? Does it do well?
It does well. It does well. It is. We're using both Tango and Daydream as well as the AR kit. And it definitely does well. And again, in trying to generate 3D, now we're doing a couple funky things with it, but it's I think Tango is a more accurate solution, but again, it also
not
really
available.
Eats up. Well, it's unavailable. It eats up battery. It's, you know, and I think that.
Right.
But I think that these two may, when we look at all the rumors that are kind of floating around, I think that the difference between Tango and ARKit will be significantly smaller after the release of the phone, iPhone 8, than it is right now.
Matt says, I highly recommend reading this. And of course, you know all this, but Matt's been working in AR for 9 years. He's built, he says, technology is identical to ARKit. But the title of his article is Why ARKit is Better Than the Alternatives. And a lot of it is because Apple, and they've always said this, controls the full stack, the hardware and the software. And you've got 100 million plus devices that are going to suddenly be able to use it.
The install base.
If you're a developer, you immediately say, well, there's no question. Am I going to develop for Tango or am I going to develop for ARKit? There's no question.
Well, have a contiguous
it depends. It could be something like Google Glass for Enterprise where Google could be perfectly happy creating the AR platform that the military will definitely want to use, that the government will want to definitely want to use, that engineers will definitely want to use. It won't be quite so good for putting cartoon monsters on a park bench and then throwing a baseball at it, but it will be really, really good for putting online documentation and walking less skilled workers through what would be a very, very complicated repair job, or something that would allow a camera manufacturer to suddenly have incredible effects available to consumers that would be just crazy to contemplate 2 or 3 years ago. So I think that the most important feature of ARKit or any augmented reality is going to be presenting to a general user something that is just compelling and useful and relevant.
But that's the risk, Andy. And if it doesn't look good, it's going to end up like VR has, which is, a very promising technology. We thought this was great. We all tried it, and then it was like, yeah, fine.
Well, I mean, there's such a thing. That's a good point, but there is such a thing as good enough. Maybe people don't necessarily want the photorealistic.
I agree. It has to get to good enough.
Maybe what they really want is, what if I have iMovie and I have the ability to simply tag every face that's recognized will actually have a little caption that follows this person around? Or what if this person, my daughter really, really loves Wonder Woman and I want her interacting with Wonder Woman and I can just simply download a plugin or a model for iMovie that will put Wonder Woman in the scene, and maybe they can't actually talk because that would be very, very expensive. I don't know how much gig costs for looping 8 million kids videos per day, but it's what excites me about ARKit above Tango. I love the precision of Tango. I love what it could do to actually create, again, more practical, functional solutions. But I like the idea that ARKit is, you know what, it's as if Apple is saying, we have no idea what augmented reality is
and
good
for.
We have absolutely the last clue on how to actually monetize this. We just thought, what the hell? What if we just introduce an API that's not perfect by any means, but will allow a lot of people to try a lot of things? And if it has an effect on Tango by saying, wouldn't it be great if this really great ruler app that simply lets you on the iPhone that lets you take a measurement of a window just by holding up your phone to it and reading a measurement that's off of it. What if that were accurate to the millimeter instead of accurate to within an inch? And what if we, because that's one of the most downloaded apps on the App Store right now, looking forward to 2 or 3 months in the future. So that's why I think that in the history of augmented reality, ARKit is going to be more important from what I see right now than Tango is, because it'll kickstart all that sort of innovation and idea thinking.
We can't forget Microsoft's and HoloLens, but it's not going to be out for another year and a half or 2 years. They said 2019. But Mike says in this article that arguably HoloLens has the best hardware, but it's not a player. Similarly, Tango's not a player because Google never really made it a platform. He said, had Google made Tango ubiquitous on Android, it would look like iPhone was playing catch up.
The hard part is, again, the performance issues and so on and so forth. I think everybody's just getting started.
I think the new iPhone will be designed to respond to those performance questions, right?
I think so. I think it's
built for that.
Right. And I think that ARKit is definitely much easier to develop for. So if you're going to do something first, you're going to do it on ARKit.
Right.
You know, Tango is going to give you some tools that you don't have right now. The good news is that a lot of your development is not being done in Xcode or into something else. You're doing it in Unity or Unreal Engine, and then you're figuring out how you customize it for the export. So that, you know, a lot of the development is not going to be either or. Like, most of the stuff that we're looking at is both.
Right.
You know, like, it's not like, just make sure that it works on everything that's out there. You don't need to make that choice very, very often, because the real challenge with most of the AR and VR, at least the stuff that we're working on, is really all the back end development of figuring out how you're going to acquire the data, how you're going to build it out. And the only thing that you really have to worry about for the platform is how you're interfacing with that information.
Right.
So I don't think people are going to have to make choices, but our pattern right now is still to build stuff for ARKit and see if it works really quickly. And then go into Tango, unless we're trying to do precision, you know, like, we need to know exactly where we are in the space.
Good article. Highly recommend it.
It's a great article. I read that.
Did you read it? Yeah. And I think there's a lot of really, for somebody like me who doesn't work as you do deeply with this stuff, this is a very good basic introduction to how AR works, why Apple has an advantage, and it's chiefly because they have the hardware and software platforms together, and what a challenge it is. One of the things he says is there are only about 20 people in the world who have the skills to build this kind of hardware, but most of them are building cruise missile tracking systems or Mars rover navigation systems. They're not working in consumer mobile.
Well, and most of that, I think in that specific thing, I think it was a lot of the inertial stuff.
Yes.
That's where the real challenge.
Well, and there's also a huge challenge in doing it with a single RGB camera.
Right, which is going to go away.
He says that's 18 months off at least. So we're not going to see the really, and that's maybe why Microsoft said, you know what, we're not going to try to ship a consumer product till 2019. That's when the hardware will really be there.
And when we look at VR also, I mean, you know, HD came out in Japan in the 80s. You know, we didn't really see it in any kind of penetration until, you know, for 20 years later. And so I think that, you know, a lot of this stuff is very much in its very early stages of what's going on here. And I think that things are going to get, they're going to get pretty interesting, because we have a lot of very large companies that are all fighting for space, which is really good for us as consumers.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting observation, though, about HD. Like, maybe it was a feature that consumers were delighted to get for free. They weren't en masse entirely motivated to pay extra for it before it was impossible to buy a TV that wasn't at least 720 HD. Maybe that's going to be the truth of AR too, that it's not going to be something that people are going to be willing to buy something to get. If it's built into a phone, they're really happy to get it for free. And then consequently, they're happy to then buy content that uses AR. So,
well, I think a lot of the uses are not going to be individuals buying AR. I think it's going to be locations and people and companies using AR as a marketing tool, as a information
tool. Well, like
tool.
IKEA's proposed app, which would let you look at your room and put IKEA furniture in it. That makes a lot of sense.
Yep.
That doesn't have to be perfect. It's okay if the chair is floating a little bit. You still can kind of get a sense what that furniture would look like, how it would fit into your room. I think for IKEA, that's a no-brainer. That's a great product.
And again, if you look at the other end of that, let's just take real estate for just a second. Maybe IKEA builds a bunch of all their furniture, or Pottery Barn builds all their furniture in 3D, ready for a platform, ready to show it. The real estate agent goes in and acquires all the information of the house, both lighting models and data.
And then presents
Now you can sit there and you can say, I want to put this furniture in, and I want to look at it, and I can see what it looks like. Those are the kind of things that are not that far away. Again, it's not being paid for by the consumer, but it's selling the house.
That's the Tango-style mapping, where you pre-map a space. It's now a model, which you could then send to a customer with in some, you know, this is what the paint job will look like, or...
Yeah. And you really have, you can then they can really envision it any way they want to envision it, and all of that stuff's there. And you know, a lot of us have talked about that for 15 years. It's just that the technology is finally getting up to speed. And, you know, acquiring the house with Tango would be very slow and cumbersome, but there are really good tools for that that are much faster.
We just need drones. We need drones that
they
will just go and map the whole thing. I saw that in Alien. I know you can do it.
The Yeah, the LiDAR drones are about 15,000 each.
Oh, okay, never mind.
Reference. So they're out there. No, but you can.
Here's my concern, and you guys can tell me whether you think it's on or not. I think VR ended up being a disappointment. And I think by overselling VR, Facebook and other companies have actually damaged what VR will become in the future. And I think there's a risk here that by overselling AR, when consumers get their hands on it, that it's going to be like VR or 3D TV. They're going to go, oh, gimmick, nice, but I don't care. And that would damage what will happen in 18 months or whatever.
Well, and we've been playing with AR for a while. I mean, these are AR maps, and people had stuff.
This is not new stuff.
No, it's not. But the problem was when it was only inertial, and we talked about this years ago, right. As soon as they start tracking the points, we were going to get a much better version of this. And the thing is that I think it's going to be one of the things you're going to use AR as often as you look at Google Maps.
Once it's good enough.
And I don't think it'll be.
That the risk is short term. If it's crappy and it's just a gimmick.
And I think that's the challenge for ARKit. Without the laser that I think we're going to end up, you know, what the rumor is we're going to start seeing those.
In the new iPhone?
I think we're going to see some more depth information from the new iPhone. I mean,
it's
pretty
clear that they're designing this around AR.
Yeah, so I think you're going to see that. I think, you know, from the rumors that we've seen so far going by, and I think that if we get that, that data is pretty accurate pretty quickly. I think the challenge with AR is that right now, you know, when you're testing it, it is, you know, it slides around. It, you know, it's trying to find things. It's trying to, you know, it's the finding planes is difficult. It's very hard with a single sensor to get to be accurate.
And VR's problem was it made people nauseous. AR is not going to make people nauseous. You're not wearing it. It's not your entire world.
I think VR has a whole bunch of problems. As someone who shoots a lot of it.
But making people nauseous is a pretty big problem.
Yeah, I mean, that's a frame rate issue.
I know. I understand. Or whatever. I mean, there's convergence. I mean, there may be other reasons for it. But for whatever reason, if somebody tries VR and gets sick, they're much less likely to try it again.
No, absolutely.
I mean, that's kind of the end of that for that person.
But I think that the again, frame rates are a big issue with that nauseousness. It tends to be frame rate interaxial distance for the camera, but interocular distance are the two things that cause that problem.
They always say that, and they say, "Oh, the new one's got so much frame rate, and still makes people sick, though."
It's the
simulator sickness.
So part of that is
super high vision is so high resolution it makes people sick.
it's too good now.
One of the big problems with AR with VR video is that to make things look more 3D, people who acquire it will create an interaxial distance, the distance between the virtual cameras.
Right.
They'll spread that out a little bit because it makes everything more 3D. But when you take it off, And so so keeping that interaxial to a really comfortable level, things don't look as impressive. They don't look as 3D. But when you take it off, you can always tell if it's a good acquisition when you can take the goggles off and it doesn't feel like your eyes pop.
Right.
When your eyes pop, that means that someone stretched it too far. If it looks flat, then they didn't stretch it enough. You know, those are the things that you know, people, again, they damage the platform when they try to push it further than what it's ready to go. But I think most people, like what we're looking at, is integrated solutions where we're not thinking about AR, VR. We're thinking about AR and VR. Like if everything we do, we're going to capture
reality.
That data.
Yeah.
But I think that's the future of you're going to, because what's really hard is acquiring all that data.
Right.
It's not hard to make it, put it on your headset, you know? And so acquiring all that data properly and really with high accuracy is going to help AR, but it's also, people will use it later for VR.
Renee, anything else from the quarterly results we should note?
No, again, the big thing to me was just how aggressive, maybe aggressive is the wrong word, but how good the forecasts for next quarter were. And it seemed to include all sorts of
very
good
bullish,
stuff. Shipping.
Very bullish.
Yeah. And we had the best Apple Watch quarter ever, but it's an Amazon number, so nobody really knows.
The Amazon number was 50% increase. It was the best quarter ever over what? We don't know.
No, we don't know. Yeah. But they're selling, I forget, Ben Beharin had a number, but it was still, I mean, they're firing on all cylinders now.
I have to say,
Macs were up.
As much as I think the Apple Watch is not a very interesting product, I see more and more of them all the time. I see a lot of non-geeky, normal people wearing them all the time. So the consciousness of the watch and desire for the watch has definitely penetrated the market.
If we just
and there was some fear. There was some fear when they discontinued the iPods, and people were like, "What are we going to use for athletics and for running?" And I think more clearly with the rumors towards future Apple Watches that this is going to sort of take the place of the thing that was under the iPod Touch.
Andy,
as we go forward,
you had something to say.
No, I was just going to say, I think that just reflects that Apple is Apple knows now what they're selling.
Right.
They were selling it earlier for the first 2 years to believers, to people who said people are lining up to say, oh, we have great faith that whatever a smartwatch is going to be great. We're going to love it. Now Apple is saying this is a really great fitness watch, and it also is a really good fashion watch. And if you like fashion and you don't mind being a little bit fitter, give us $300 so we can help you on both accounts.
We will talk about the watch because there's rumors that there will be a new watch in 2 months or a month. But we'll talk about that in a second. Mark Gurman, usually very accurate. I did want to mention the one last piece of the analyst call. This is Jason Snell writing at Macworld.com. Almost every analyst call, someone tries to trick Apple executives into revealing their secret plans. So this time it was RBC Capital Markets' Amit Daryanani who asked, should we believe the blogs and the component suppliers that the new iPhone might be delayed? Tim Cook said, we have no comment on anything that's not announced, to which Daryanani replied, fair enough. I figured it was worth a shot. And then, I love this, the microphones in Cupertino picked up an entire room full of Apple executives laughing out loud. Nice try, Amit. Nice try.
There was one other thing that was interesting. When they asked him about automation, because he's been more willing to talk about automation, sort of like he was willing to talk about augmented reality than Apple typically is about future products. And he was pretty clear that automation, like augmented reality, they're not thinking about one product. So maybe a car is an obvious one, but they're thinking about automation across a wide, a core technology like AR.
Yeah. Well, and as Alex just pointed out, the LiDAR and the things that map the road for self-driving cars have absolute practicality in AR and other things. So kind of a beneficial...
And on the LiDAR market, you know, Leica just created relatively cheaper LiDAR system.
Right. Well, that was Google's big lawsuit against Waymo and Lewandowski, is that he'd stolen the cheap, because Google's LiDAR is one-tenth what it costs for the regular LiDAR, and they said he gave it to Uber. That's why they're suing.
Well, and this is one that just scans the room or an accident scene or whatever, and it's $16,000, you know, for this little a lot of people are calling a coffee can. It's like this little LiDAR.
So it's system. A static LiDAR system.
Yeah, you set it on a tripod and you scan stuff, but because of AR, the demand for this thing it's a 20-week waiting period for them to. Now these are very high precision instruments, so it's hard to get them anyway. But it's hard to build. It's hard to just increase the number that you're going to make. So Leica can only make them at a certain pace.
And it doesn't make a picture of them. It makes a 3D model.
It'll do a picture as well.
Oh, it will do.
Because it uses the picture to, it can use it mostly to color the vertices.
Textures for the model.
Because all it does is it goes out and grabs a whole bunch of points.
Right.
It says, I'm just going to grab all these points. And then it colors all the points based on the color that it's scanning.
Right.
So that it
kind of
looks like
a room.
Oh, it looks, on a high density scan, it'll look like the...
Right.
I mean, it'll really look like the room, except there's just no real surface to it. And then you run it through another conversion to put surfaces to the points.
And, of course, you have one.
I don't have one. I don't have
it. Is that your pick this week?
No. I don't have one. I have friends with LiDAR.
Only 700 Alexes. No more than that. All right, let's take a break. We'll come back. We will talk about Mark Gurman in the next watch. Get your impressions. Renee Ritchie is here. From Canada, by the way, Renee, I wore something for you today.
Oh, excellent.
This is my new T-shirt that represents how we feel about Canada here in the United States of America.
Monsieur Trudeau. Excellent. With the moose and the polar bear and
there's
the goose.
A moose. And we've decided that Serenity Caldwell riding the polar bear over here. I mean, the moose over here.
With her skate. That's awesome. That's terrific.
Oh,
thank you, Leo.
Oh, Canada. I got that at headlines.com if you want your own. I should send you one.
You too can get your Justin shirt.
But I think it's fair that Americans should wear this, right? And then when I go, apparently they're using, what was it, the Rogers Stadium or something in Toronto to accommodate all the people fleeing the United States to become Canadian refugees?
It's really kind of
did you see that?
We have all the land up to the North Pole, Leo. We are set for everybody.
Do you have anywhere that doesn't have a cold winter?
We cling to the border for warmth. If you would just install a heat pump, if you could install a heat pump at the Windsor-Detroit border, we could just sort of air match. It would be phenomenal.
Also with us, Andy Anako from the Chicago Sun-Times. Hi, Andy.
Who?
You seem a little subdued today. Are you okay?
I'm a little under the weather.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
We're sending good thoughts, Andy.
Sending chicken soup. That would be more useful.
For your soul.
Chicken soup for your soul. and Alex Lindsay in studio. Thank you for coming up here. Please come up more often. It's nice. It's so nice to see you.
It's good to be here.
In here. Our show today brought to you by WordPress. WordPress, of course, hosts my blog. I used to run my own self-hosted WordPress, which everybody still can do. But I spent a lot of time messing with it, which was why I had it. And eventually I thought, you know, probably better to spend that time blogging. So I went to WordPress.com. WordPress.com does the hosting. They do the security updates, the patching, and they give me a great-looking blog. WordPress is the best-known platform for websites. I'll tell you how well-known. 28% of all websites run on WordPress. 28%. They power the entire internet, practically. Why? Because it's a solid code base that works really well, has universal support. Almost every blogging tool, right out of the box, it's going to work with WordPress. So you have not just the great WordPress content management system that you can enter content into, and that's actually usually what I use, just the web-based version, but their third-party programs like our friend Daniel Jalkut's Red Sweater blog, his Mars Edit. Fantastic. Works beautifully with WordPress.com. Look, whether you're a blogger or you're a business, and we always talk about my blog, but frankly, it's more important for small businesses. You've got to have a website. And where should you start it? At WordPress.com. Make it easier for your customers to find you, connect with you, hear how you can help them. Every single business. It used to be you had to have a Yellow Pages entry. Now, forget the Yellow Pages. You need an online home, a WordPress.com website. By the way, it's easy. I know your business is not designing websites, so you don't want to become a webmaster, but you don't need to. You can use WordPress very easily. Go to WordPress.com and click the Get Started button and pick a template and start entering contents. That's simple. But you can also, if you want, there are so many great developers. There's such great third-party support for WordPress. And, of course, a great community of people at WordPress.com who will help you, not to mention WordPress's own fantastic support team. I've used them, and they're really good. Boost your visibility. Every single WordPress.com site has search engine optimization. Social sharing, I use that. I mean, that's really important. Not to mention the fact that you can say, follow me on your WordPress site. And because there's such a big community at WordPress.com, almost instantly, 500,000 people started following me. It was mind-blowing. 28% of all websites run on WordPress. Find out why. Some of the best, biggest publications on the internet, like Quartz.com, run on WordPress. Get started today with 15% off any new plan purchase. 15% at WordPress.com/MacBreak. Create your new website. Find the plan that's right for you at WordPress.com/MacBreak and save 15%. And I just want to thank WordPress for giving me such a great platform. Everybody, such a great platform for so many years. I'm a huge fan. LeoLaporte.com if you want to see my WordPress blog. Mark Gurman. Now at Bloomberg. Boy, wasn't that a good acquisition for Bloomberg? Wow.
I've heard of him.
He, of course, became famous at 9 to 5 Mac. We quote him all the time. Probably because he's a very sweet, humble guy. I saw him at Google I.O. this year. Met him for the first time, and I was really impressed by him. But one of the reasons I think people like him and talk to him because he is such a nice guy, and he gets the best scoops out of Apple. He's got great sources. His story earlier this week, Apple plans to release a cellular-capable watch to break iPhone times. Intel said to supply the modem. It works with cell networks. Apple, according to Gurman, plans to sell this new Apple Watch Series 3 this year. Now, I do want to find a little fault with Mark. It's not probably his fault, but he... in his interview on Bloomberg and in his article, kind of implied that this is a breakthrough. It's a breakthrough for Apple, but I have to point out others have done this a lot. Samsung, and I have an LG Android Wear watch that has it's built in. It has its own SIM card, and it allows you to make phone calls as well as access to data. I get the impression from reading Mark's story that this is not for making phone calls. This is really about LTE data, so you can get maps, you can stream music.
It's a very delicate balance. Like they've had, as far as I know, and like you never know without, but they've had they've been working on LTE Apple Watches since before the first Apple Watch came out. And it's always been a question of battery efficiency and thermal. Like the original Apple Watch ran at the thermal limits of that design. You just could not make that device hotter. And subsequently, they added more battery because they have a list of things that they consider to be important to people that they want to solve for. And they added GPS and they added more battery life so people could do the workout and not run out by the end of the day. And sort of cellular is on that list. So I don't know if it will ship this year. It depends on whether it provides enough battery life if it just came out and suddenly it was a half a day battery life, that'd be a non-starter for them. So provided they could provide sufficient battery life, that watch will ship when they hit that point.
It's not just battery life because the phone watches I have from Samsung and LG are massive.
Well, theirs is not. See, that's the thing. Is that, and I think the original model of the quote was it would burn your wrist off.
Right.
So that's
not, you don't want that.
Also, I think that's part of the future of Apple Watch. I started I liked the special June Pride watch band so much that that's what finally got the Apple Watch out of the drawer for the first time in months, because I just thought it was a very, very pretty band. And it got me, even though I'm not primarily an iPhone user, realizing how good a fitness watch it is and how good a media watch it is, even if you're just using it with an Android phone. And that's all you're getting from it. So it'd be nice to have cellular on it, particularly if it's being used primarily as a data connection as opposed to a voice connection. But if it means that I now have to get another account on another service, if it means that I have to get a new data plan for my existing service, that wouldn't be a really great move forward, at least not for me. What I think that Apple should really do is move forward just on the basic idea of making this a generic device that will happily talk to that will happily talk to Android as well as iPhone, to take it away from its first generation idea of you're going to have a watch that can work as sort of a terminal for apps that are running on a phone, have everything running directly on the phone, have it just connect intermittently to a host phone if it's present, just for syncing purposes and for status purposes, but allow people to simply just put this on, play whatever music they want, get access to fitness information off of any app that they want. I think that really needs to go in the same direction as the iPod did, where it was originally a Mac-only product. And then once you realize that there are only about 10% or fewer of desktops around the world are Macs, and the 90% of the people have money to spend on watches, perhaps you should sell to people who have Android phones as well as iPhones as well, if you really want to get just to the potential of the product.
German says that the phone would probably be sold as, or the watch rather, the phone watch, I guess I should call it, would be sold by carriers in carrier stores. That's how they do the other ones, AT&T, Verizon, Sprint, and T-Mobile. The new device could still be delayed beyond 2017. Indeed, the company, this is German talking, had already postponed a cellular-capable smartwatch last year.
Well, and I think that there is an opportunity for, you know, while it may be a lot of data, being able to walk out with your AirPods and your watch.
But you could do that now. You just can't get streaming music. You
wouldn't
have 4 gigs.
Answer the phone, though. You know, like, you know, not
well,
have to reach
that's,
up.
And again, he never mentions using it as a phone here.
Right. I'm just saying that would be really convenient.
But yeah, I mean, these are things that you can easily add. I can give me $80. I can go on eBay or Amazon and buy a really horrible Chinese watch that can do those things. That will be a music player. That will also. But no. I'm saying.
I get that it has a feature, but the power is always the ecosystem. I mean, that's why you don't want to use something else.
No, he's agreeing with you, Alex.
Okay. No, I'm about to finish the sentence.
Okay.
Saying that if all it did was it can act as a Bluetooth device that can pair to any phone, and when a phone call comes in, here's the phone number, here's the call ID information, touch this button, and it will act as a hands-free device for answering that phone call, that would make it so much of a nicer it's not something that would require Apple-only software to run on an Android device, for instance. I'm saying that it would be nice if I could be able to. One of the things that got me so that rekindled my interest in the Apple Watch was also having AirPods and being able to sync at least one playlist to the thing, and now rely on that as my music player. Given that I don't need to have 128 gigs of albums with me all the time, I just want to have a couple of important playlists and maybe a few recent podcasts. So it really did make me reconsider reconsider how much money Apple might be leaving on the table and how much of the potential of this device that Apple is leaving behind by requiring that there has to be an iPhone somewhere right. in the mix. Even I can make it work because I do have iPhones. I still am an iPhone user intermittently. So when it comes time to copy music onto the device, I can bring up the phone that it's paired with and do that. When it comes to updates and stuff like that, I can again produce an iPhone to make that happen. It's just very, very clear to me that these seem to be arbitrary decisions for the basic operations of the phone. And given how well it works for how well the fitness apps built into this watch work, the ability to have all the benefits, the health benefits of the Apple Watch, but also make them available to people who have not bought iPhones would be another step in the direction of Apple really underscoring their idea that we're making products to make people's lives better as opposed to maintain a 41% markup whenever we possibly can.
Well, and I think that for me, I mean, part of my problem is, you know, I have a couple different phones, and the thing is if I use them at my two different, one iPhone is for when I'm overseas and one iPhone is when I'm local. The overseas ones.
But do you want to pay for another subscription for your watch?
No, what I'm saying is that the problem right now for me is I can only sync. It's a big deal to switch phones on my watch.
I mean,
I have to sit there. They said, oh, well, you know, more than one.
But you wouldn't even need your phone. The idea is the watch does everything the phone does.
Right, and I guess
to work with an Android phone.
What I'd love to be able to do is be able to walk out of the house without my phone and know that people can still call me and I can still call them. And if I just say call my wife and it just calls, you know, that would be.
There's a lot of problems there are different problems that need to be solved, and they line up what they think are the biggest problems. And one is, if you support Android, they've got to line up everything the way they did with iTunes on Windows. And it's not overly complicated, but it is something they have to create and maintain.
Can't you use an Apple Watch with Android?
I don't buy that.
Well, but also if they believed it was last year or the year before that they were going to get the independent one out, then, you know, they're putting all their efforts towards getting an Apple Watch out that doesn't need an iPhone or an Android phone, and that might be where they're lying their wood behind. And then it slipped a year, it slipped 2 years. And the carrier thing is absolutely flummoxing too, because they deliver a pizza to your house and they count the amount of people that are going to eat it and charge you more based on that, instead of just giving you a pizza and letting anybody you want eat it. And that's my analogy for, here's your data, here's your plan. You have whatever phones you want, whatever, tablets you want, whatever watches you want, that just all comes from your bucket. Enjoy.
And I mean, that's not Apple's way of doing things.
Apple, the cellular networks.
Right.
Like the cellular networks. It shouldn't matter to them how many devices I have as long as I'm paying for the amount of data that I'm
Oh, I see. In terms of in terms of an extra subscription. Well, yeah, Google Fi works like that. You can buy, or rather get, a free data SIM from Google Fi, and it's all just part of your account. Put it in your iPad and use Google Fi's service.
And a lot of places have family plans. I could definitely imagine someone like T-Mobile saying, you know, you can use your new watch LTE.
It's just like $10 extra T-Mobile per month per device or something.
It's just data. You know, it's all free.
We're talking about the carriers. Seems highly unlikely.
But T-Mobile would be the one that would be the most likely to do that because they tend to be the most aggressive about, we're just going to make it easy for you to use it. And if they thought they could get a leg up, they would.
Over the weekend, Gruber said that he heard there's a new watch coming this year, a new design.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was one of the things he dropped.
So that kind of confirms this idea. And a Series 3 watch with no new software, right? iOS 11 will come to the watch, I presume.
WatchOS 4.
Four. Okay. All right.
Yeah, one last comment that I forgot to make, though, that the other cool thing about when you're using it as a watch, not necessarily connected to a phone, whether it's an iPhone or an Android device, oh my God, the battery life on this thing. When it's not checking in with the phone, you get days of battery life. It becomes a Fitbit. And that's another reason why I'm thinking, oh goodness, if the sooner that Apple banks this as a standalone device, kind of like an iPod, where so long as you occasionally bring it to a computer to refresh data or update apps, the better. It's so much. Again, I just keep coming back to the word potential. It really made me think there's so much potential in this device that isn't being tapped.
If it's smart about how it uses the LTE, because of course the iPhone, if it loses signal to its cell towers, it's one of the fastest ways to burn your battery.
So this would be the opposite, which is why I think they're being very conservative about the functionality they enable, is that LTE still does race to sleep very well. So if it can sip data and shut down really fast, it prolongs battery life, where if it's doing phone calls or streaming Apple Music, it's got to keep that connection on. And that's when you start creating the heat and the battery drain.
Right.
Mm. I'm even talking about without LTE. I'm talking about a first, second, third generation watch that is just has Wi-Fi, is intended to be not something that keeps in communication with a style of usage, not a new piece of software or a new piece of hardware, but a style of usage that says we are going to support you if you decide that you don't care about connectivity to a phone. And it becomes a really interesting device after that, I think.
And because of the idiosyncrasies of syncing the phone, I had this thing, I switched phones and then I killed a phone and then my watch was connected to the phone that I had wiped out. And now it doesn't.
That's problematic, by the way, with the Apple Watch. They don't.
It is.
That's hard. You have to.
I haven't done it yet. So I've spent like a month with it not connected to anything. It's just a watch, you know, and it does.
That's
to
keep people from stealing it. So what you get that from Apple?
Well, no. So there's. I thought he meant the health data, because the health data is one of the few things that still doesn't sync, and you can use a utility to copy that off and copy it to another watch or another phone.
I don't care about the data.
Yeah, but what he wants to do is pair his watch to a different phone.
But you have to go back to one phone and release it, and then send it. And then
there must be.
You can unpair it. You can unpair it on the watch. You can tell it to erase all settings.
It's just one of those things I haven't gotten around to.
But that's the key. You have to erase the watch to have that.
That's fine. I've switched the watch so many times that losing the data is something I'm kind of used to.
I've done it several times.
I know this is a tangent, but I was out with my phone today and I got this text from Rogers that said, you have used all your data for the month. And I ignored it because I was on the road. And then I got another one an hour later that said, you have now accrued $90 worth of roaming charges. We're going to shut down your data connection unless you press this button. So I pressed the button and then I called them. And they said, oh yeah, our overage is $70 a gigabyte.
Whoa.
I tweeted it, and this lawyer tweeted back going, yeah, actually, the Canadian government caps it at 50, but when you press that button, you're agreeing to override that cap to 70. And I'm like, I don't have a choice. It's no data, or I override the cap. There's no. So, I mean, cellular companies are still, you know, not.
It used to be that way. I think that like Verizon and a lot of them are now like $10 a gig over it, and we still, yeah.
$70 a gig was.
I got to tell you, it's just as bad in Canada. Rogers is just as bad as any of our cell companies. These guys will gouge you at any possible opportunity.
I thought he said seven. I asked him three times to repeat the word 70.
70. Wow.
70 a gig, domestic, not even roaming. Wow.
I like Google Fi. It's $10 a gig, period.
I just want, yeah.
Whatever you want. Please. Use as much as you want. I got another SIM for my iPad mini. Put it, because that's one of the few LTE iPads I have. Put it in. Works. It thinks it's on T-Mobile. It's great.
That's great.
Oh, yeah. By the time I called them, it had gone up to $140. Like, I got the first message, then the second message was $90. By the time I called them, it was $140.
Well, and the worst part is that a lot of times with the stuff like with Facebook, sometimes, you know, uploading images in the background or with that Wi-Fi assist.
Instagram, Snapchat.
I had one month and I was getting slowed down because I still have, of course, the old AT&T. Yeah. And I was getting slowed down. I was like, how much have I actually used? I looked at my phone. It was like 240 gigs. You know, it was just like,
I want to do brain
surgery. I'm one of those guys. All that video, right? Like, pre-fetching video.
Yeah. My new Lenovo laptop, because I've stopped buying Apple laptops. My new Lenovo laptop supports LTE. I didn't get the radio, so I have to open it up. You can buy the radio and plug it in. It just plugs in. And then I could use a Google. The reason I didn't do it is because I don't want another full subscription. But once I found out I could just have Google Fi, get a free SIM, put it in there, and it's on my existing account. So that's a good solution. And if the carriers do that, I wonder if they will. But if the carriers do that, then I wouldn't mind having a watch with LTE as long as it's part of my existing subscription.
I'd buy more data. Right. They'd make more money off of it.
They'd make more money, wouldn't they, in the long run?
Yeah.
And by the way, LTE ultimately is going to carry voice. That's going to be the only way voice works probably is in LTE in the next year or two.
I think all of my stuff is voice over LTE now.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, you're still using probably the others, whatever the other technologies, you know, CDMA or GSM on a lot of calls. But ultimately, it'll all be LTE.
And once it used to drop to HSPA when you would do a voice call because LTE couldn't transit it. And I haven't seen that anymore.
That's
now it's just
a CDMA
LTE.
Phone. That was one of the issues of CDMA.
Well, no, even GSM. CDMA wouldn't let you do voice and data over EVDO. But even LTE wouldn't let you do voice and data at the same time. So you would drop to HSPA on a GSM network in order to do the voice. And now with voice over LTE, Volte, that's gone too. It's terrific.
So I would hope that even if the Apple Watch 3, Series 3 isn't voice initially, that it would ultimately support Volte.
Or like FaceTime and Skype, and there's so many just a bits of bits. Yeah.
Then you really have a Dick Tracy watch.
Well, FaceTime audio. I mean, you know, they have the audio.
No, I want video. You know, I have to say, I have Nest cameras watching my driveway, and if somebody's moving in my driveway, I get a picture of them on my Apple Watch. That is pretty freaking awesome.
It's amazing. And some of the doorbells do that too?
Yeah, the Ring doorbell will do that too. Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty awesome. All right. All right, one question. Poll. We'll poll the chat room, and I'll poll you guys too. If you had a choice between an Apple Watch that used its battery to keep the face on all the time or an Apple Watch that used its battery to put an LTE chip in there, which would you choose?
All the time.
All the time.
All the time, yeah.
All
yeah.
the time.
Oh, my gosh.
All the Apple? All the time.
You get into
the
thing where you go like this. A watch that currently doesn't work as a watch.
You see everybody go like this.
Yeah.
It's like this.
And then you have to do the wrist snap because it doesn't. Yeah. But if you do too much of a wrist snap.
Like an animal.
Like an animal. We are not animals. Look at the chat room. LTE,
it's not just that.
Go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I'll just say it's not just that, but us old timers born before 2000, like there was only one time we were ever programmed to check our watch like this, and that's when like we are at a restaurant and the hostess said, "Oh, I'm sure we'll have a table for you in the next 5 minutes," and that was 20 minutes ago, and you really want to be rude, say, "Hi, yes, see, I'm really looking at my watch now," as opposed to I'm having lunch with somebody that I'm enjoying having that time with, and I just need to make sure that I know that I have a train that I have to catch in about 45 minutes. So I don't want to send the message that if I'm doing – I want to explicitly say, "Hi, I'm sorry. I need to check the time, and my watch does not work unless I do the rude time check gesture."
So we have one vote for LTE and then all the rest for full-time, all-the-time watch face. And then one vote for everything. I want it all.
I want it all and longer battery life. Double the battery life and give me all the features.
That's really Apple's challenge right watch. Now. They've got to come up with a new – because I have to say the two watches I have that have LTE in them are too big and ugly to wear.
The original one was the size of the original iPhone, the original Samsung LTE
Samsung
watch.
It looked like you had a little phone on your
–
The one I have, the new Android Wear one from LG, is still too big and clunky, and that's because they had to put all that extra battery in there. It's probably also the radio takes up a little more room too. So
But that's what I would love to see is both if it moved in both directions, both make it way, 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 way more connected with an LTE model, but also explicitly we are going to knock another $20-$30 off the price and make it really, really easy to use it just as a watch, totally separated from whatever else you're doing.
Well, as long as we're doing that, why don't we put time travel in there as well? We got the knob.
I'm there.
Yeah. I mean, literal time travel, not just on the watch.
Like in Doctor Strange. Like in Doctor Strange, where he turns his hands and time goes backwards.
Oh, I love that.
That was awesome.
That's, you know, forget flying or invisibility. That's my power. That's my secret. We didn't mention that services are now the number two revenue generator at Apple.
Yeah.
It's iPhone, services, and all the rest.
If you can't get more customers, you get more money from the customers you have.
That's a real – somebody wrote an article I thought was quite good that really imperceptibly, so lowly we didn't really notice it. Apple's gone from being a hardware company to being a services, software, and hardware company. I mean, like a whole different company. And that is a whole different mindset. It's a whole different way of making money. How does that change Apple? Andy took the first breath.
I was gonna say that my first reaction to this is kind of like saying that we make $32 billion off of our sales of Coke, Diet Coke, and Moxie. It's like, okay, I'm guessing you're making most. It's the App Store. I had to double check it, but like we were estimating last, based on Tim Cook's keynote explanation of here's how much money we've handed out to developers in the past year, that was causing us to speculate that Apple revenue from the App Store was about $28 billion in and of itself last year. That doesn't really indicate how much money they're making off of music, how much money they're making off of storage. These aren't areas in which Apple dominates. They have a really good presence and really good products, but I really wish they would break that sort of thing down. I think that if Apple has one big problem that they hate and would love to solve, it's that of never being able to manufacture enough products to sell for all the people who want to buy them. And for them to get back into services allows them to cut out the entire process of manufacture. It allows them to express their design philosophy. And remember, they are a design company as much as they are an engineering company. I don't mean that as an insult. I'm just observing that of the things that drive this company, really great design or design that really appeals to Apple is one of those things. And yeah, I mean, I think that they're as aware as anybody else of the question, what happens when all of a sudden, nobody wants to buy BlackBerries anymore? Nobody wants to buy phones with keyboards attached to them anymore, even though we were making so much money that we didn't have enough denominations of money to burn to start the fire of the pile of money we were burning at the party because we have so much money that we have to get rid of some of it. What happens when maybe the iPhone becomes just another phone and they don't know exactly what to replace it with? And the answer is to make sure that they have making lots of money off of services. They've seen how much money Google is making from services. They've seen how much money getting rid of ad sales. They've seen how much money that Amazon, of all people, is making off of services. They've seen how much money that Microsoft is making. I mean, these companies have really nice front-facing products, but the thing is they make steam pipes, and they make a huge amount of money off of steam pipes because every industry is running off of steam these days. So if you really want an app or a service, you're going to have to buy some capacity from one of these companies that sells ebooks, $50 tablets, sweaters at a discount, and also web app services. So yeah, this is Apple trying to diversify itself, trying to make sure that it's got as many revenue streams as possible to try to future proof its success as much as possible. And I think we're certainly going to see more of this.
It's also interesting to me because there was a big debate previously whether Apple was a software or hardware company, and it started to strike me that it's not either of those things. It's not even really a product company. It's a differentiated experiences company, and increasingly you need services to provide that. Like they figure out what they want to do, and services is an increasing part of that. And now the threats are coming from services. Like if you look at WeChat in China, it's become such a big platform that it just abstracts away even the hardware, software, and other services underneath it. And if you want to protect yourself and protect, and like Andy said, your company, you have to start offering services that are as important to people. Whatever people see first, that doesn't matter what the pipes are. The interface is the application. The display is the hardware, all of those things. You've got to give them something that keeps them on that platform.
Actually, somebody in the chat room pointed out that although iPhone sales revenue went down in China, App Store sales went through the roof. And that shows you where services can even out revenue. Even in a place where you're not selling the hardware, having
all those WeChat downloads.
Yeah.
I do think that they're all, as Renee was saying, I think the services are less about revenue to Apple and more about creating a powerful ecosystem that everyone stays tied into. You know, that there
well,
is.
Certainly works.
You know, I think that it works. Yeah. They're making a lot of money on it, but I think that the primary reason that they're doing the services is to make sure that you stay attached to this entire ecosystem.
I think that's how it started. But now they're making
now it's become
billions,
more of a focus.
So why not keep?
Well, no, I think it's like a revenue capacitor where it really just evens out.
Exactly.
We were talking earlier about how revenue from, let's say, hardware spikes on a release and spikes on a release and spikes on a release and spikes on a release, and there's no problem with that so long as that's not the only way you're making money. When you're selling apps, you're selling apps to everybody who has ever bought an Apple device, and they're not waiting for the next version of Lightroom. They're not waiting for the next version of their HP 65 calculator app to come out. There's a steady flow of revenue coming in from at least this source, and if that source is in the tens of billions of dollars, that's an umbrella for a rainy day.
Did we talk last week about Vic Gundotra's post on Facebook? I can't remember. You weren't here.
I don't know.
I don't think we did. Let's talk. It came out last week, exactly. But let's talk about the guy who started Google Plus posting on Facebook to say, you don't want an Android phone, just get an iPhone. We'll talk about that in just a second. And that'll be a good segue into your article on iPhone photography and iOS 11. But first, I want you, Alex, to smell that.
Oh, that smells good. It's good.
It does. How about this? Smell this. Smell this. And look at my hair while you're smelling it.
Quite nice.
I would make you smell my hair, but you could smell that, and that's what give you. This is the Wanderer Hydrating Sage and Black Pepper. See, for a man, you don't want to smell like perfume.
That's the right
smell.
You
want to smell like sage and black pepper. This is the shampoo, and this is the body cleanser. And sulfate, I love this, sulfate-free, no parabens. No synthetic dyes. This is a new product from Dollar Shave Club, our sponsor, Dollar Shave
Club.
But
you use it even when you're not shaving your head.
Yeah, right. No, this is right. this is your body wash and this is your shampoo. What I like about Dollar Shave Club, they've kind of pioneered the idea of subscribing to get your personal care products in the mail so you don't have to think about having a new razor blade. That was a revolution for me, the idea that I always had a fresh razor blade. I changed my razor blades on Monday. And I always know I've got a fresh razor blade, so I don't cut myself. By the way, one of the things I love about Dollar Shave Club, I'm going to find somebody who tests this, but it's my opinion they are the sharpest blades on the market today. And you might say, I don't want a sharp blade, but you do want a sharp blade. You're going to cut yourself less. It's like having a good cooking knife versus a dull cooking knife. You're going to cut yourself less. You're going to get a closer shave, and you're not going to get as much pulling if the blade is sharp. And I think Dollar Shave Club's blades are the best. They are absolutely the sharpest. Dollar Shave Club is the smarter choice. A great shave at a great price, conveniently delivered right to your door. This is a life hack, folks. You don't have to schlep to the store to buy a, God, don't ever do this. Get one of those blue-handled, cheap disposable razors. But that is, you want to know what a bad shave is? Use one of those razors once. No, I have my Dollar Shave Club Executive Razor. I use the Dollar Shave Club Shave Butter from Dr. Carver. Oh, that is the nicest stuff. It's transparent, which is a weird feature, but you can actually see what you're shaving. You're not shaving through this fog of war we call shave cream. I love it, and it gives you not only a better shave, but it prevents ingrown hairs, it fights razor bumps, and it smells and feels great. Your skin is softer after you shave. Make the smarter choice. Join Dollar Shave Club. We've got a great deal for you for a limited time. If you're a new member, you can get this kit for a mere $5 plus free shipping. The kit includes the executive handle, which is a very nice weighted handle with a grip, but it's made out of metal. It's really solid. You get four blades, four of the great Dollar Shave blades. And by the way, these are, you know, everything you want in a cartridge, plus the blade in the back that gives you the little trimmer for the hard to reach places. I really value that. And the lubricating strip, you get that and a full size tube of Dr. Carver's Easy Shave Butter, formula 6301-1. By the way, that formula number has never changed. I keep waiting for -2, but they never upgraded. They don't need to. It's perfect. When something's perfect. And incidentally, every time you get it, I know, again, they don't advertise this, but I love the bathroom minutes. There's a little magazine in every box. So every time you get your new box, it's got all this sort of fun little stuff in here. It's really quite good. It's kind of like the old Farmer's Almanac. And in a pinch, you could use it for toilet paper. That is the Dollar Shave Club Executive Razor plus Shave Butter plus Blades, just $5. Isn't that nice? And, of course, after your first month, you get your replacement blades automatically. This is everything you need for a month at the regular price. No hidden fees, no commitments. You can cancel easily anytime you like. And you can only get this at our site, dollarshaveclub.com/MacBreak. Dollar Shave Club. Please use that so they know you saw it here. DollarShaveClub.com/MacBreak. But while you're browsing around, take a look. They have a bunch of other products, including those butt wipes, which let's not talk too much about that. But I do.
They have butt wipes?
Yeah, and they're so you and I have Japanese toilets,
which are awesome.
So we don't need these. But when you travel, don't you miss?
Yes.
You miss the hydrating action. You feel unclean.
There was NPR had the best thing. They were talking about someone who deals with sewage systems all over the world to make sure. And they asked her, they said, we have to ask you, what do you use? And she goes, oh, I have a Japanese toilet. And he goes, because I don't dry my dishes with a paper towel.
Exactly. Exactly. Plus, we're on septic.
Right.
And it's so much better for the septic.
Right.
Anyway, I can go on and on. But when I travel, I feel bad when I travel. Because I don't have the one wipe Charlie, so I don't have the bidet, so I get the one wipe Charlies, and these are really great. They have a lot of nice little products like that, the post shave cream and so forth. But
are they pepper scented?
No, I don't. You know, that's a good question. No. I'm not going to say it. You can't get it. They also have Boogies hair styling cream, or hair pomade, which I use. The Boogies is quite nice, kind of weirdly named. The Good Shake Hand Cream.
So they're a lot. They've gone way past the whole.
Yeah, this is interesting.
I love that they just say butt wipes.
Butt wipe. Hey, you know what? Dollar Shave Club. They don't mess around. They're not going to namby pamby. This is it, and it's what you need. Aloe vera and chamomile. So I do highly recommend the Japanese toilet, but these are a lot less expensive and require no plumbing. All right, let me put that away. Thank you, Dollar Shave Club. DollarShaveClub.com/MacBreak. Vic Kundotra, who started at Microsoft, he went to Google. He lobbied for Google to get social and created Google Plus. Then when Google Plus flopped, he mysteriously disappeared. He's resurfaced, actually, at a great company, which I highly recommend, called Cardia.
What's Cardia?
Oh, this is you. Well, you don't need it yet, but as you get older, you're going to need it. Jeff Jarvis uses this. If you've ever had, it's from AliveCor, is the company. If you've ever had AFib, this is in your pocket EKG that works with your phone.
I just want to get it for fun.
It's FDA approved. It's $99. It's cheap. And yeah, I got it for fun because I don't have AFib.
Like, how am I doing now?
But I got it for fun, and you can. They will give you a diagnosis, or you could send it to your doctor for a fee. And it's FDA approved, which is one of the few one of these health devices that is FDA approved. It's an EKG. It's, you can carry in your pocket or attach it to the back of your phone.
Now you just have to be able to. You just have to put it on your chest and go clear, and just push the two buttons.
That would be the next thing. a defibrillator.
Yeah.
But if you catch sometimes AFib, you can't tell.
Right.
So of course Jarvis, who's been hospitalized twice for it, he carries this all the time, and his doctor says this is great. Anyway, that's Vic's new company. All praise to Vic Gundotra. However,
that was a big jump from
Leo. Was he the one who also said that we can't have a world where one man and one phone dictates the future? Like he had his whole screed against Steve Jobs.
Probably he was Google's interface on the Google apps with Steve Jobs. Yeah. He likes to. As Chief passed, he wrote a very moving eulogy. He told some
about
great
stories. About
the
color stories. Yellow, right?
Yeah, right.
The wrong color yellow.
Yeah. Jobs called him. He was at services on a Sunday and said, and Vic didn't answer, but he later talked to him and said, the color in the O is wrong on the Google app. It's the wrong color. It's like.
So, but he's got a history of saying bombastic things in public.
Yeah. But Vic is awesome. But he does. And this is a bombastic thing. He posts not on Google Plus, but on Facebook. First dig. The end of DSLR for most people has already arrived. I left my professional camera at home and took these shots at dinner with my iPhone 7 using computational photography, portrait mode, as Apple calls it. Hard not to call these results in a restaurant on a mobile phone with no flash stunning. And I agree. These are great pictures of his daughters. And it says, great job, Apple. And later in a comment, he says, nobody should get an Android phone. This is just the only way to go. This I might disagree with.
That's the Vic I know and love. Yeah, but that's the Vic we know edges and love.
You see the edge problem here with the back of the hair? The hair suddenly goes out of focus, even though it's really in the same focal plane. That's part of the problem with portrait. But you know what? But most people don't know that or care.
Emotionally,
about it.
It feels good.
Emotionally, that is a picture of your daughters you will love for the rest of your life, right? And that's an iPhone.
Yeah.
So I think a number of people disagreed with him about the DSLRs and disagreed with him about Android photography. But his point really is, isn't it amazing what we can do now thanks to, with small lenses and small sensors, thanks to computational photography? And that, I think that point is well taken.
It sounds like Apple's going to be one of the issues people had with him is that he was giving Apple all the credit for computational photography, where they believed that Google was a pioneer with Auto Awesome, which came about because Google never really knew what hardware you had on a phone. So all they could do was sort of suck everything up and make it look as good as possible on their servers. And now the rumor is Apple's going to be doing a version of Auto Awesome, but on device for people who just aren't comfortable with the service.
And once again, huge advantage to Apple. Because it makes the hardware and the software. It knows what you have.
It's built into the image signal processor on the phone.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was a really odd thing for him to be talking about, given that on device, Google has had a system they call HDR Plus, which goes well beyond what simple HDR does. I mean, as it happened just a week or two before that, I took one of my walks through Boston with a pocket full of phones because I had, I think, two new devices. And as usual, I just take a walk through Boston with a bunch of phones and cameras that I know how they react in all these places that I usually take pictures at, taking the exact same pictures six times with six different cameras, including the latest Galaxy S8, the latest iPhone, my Panasonic LX10, which I really, really love, which is a quote, real unquote camera. And my two-year-old Android phone over here, and a $300 Asus phone, and just taking the exact same pictures time and time again. There was a twist this time that I hadn't really counted on, because all of them, I turned on a couple of different Google Photos auto upload features that in the meantime that I forgot I'd turn on, which meant that when I went to Google Photos after being back home for about 10 minutes and things found Wi-Fi again, I suddenly had my camera roll was six copies of this exact same picture, and I couldn't tell which camera had taken which one because I have to click an info button to get that information. So I decided, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to simply pick the one I like. I create a brand new shared photo album called my Boston Walk or whatever, And I'm just going to simply, without looking at the identity of these cameras, I'm going to just pick the best, the one I like, the best of all of them. And I was expecting to see, there's some things I expected to see, but what I didn't expect to see is that overwhelmingly my favorite camera, the camera that took my favorite pictures was my two-year-old Nexus 6P made in 2015. It was the only phone of the lot that had access to the stock Android camera app and HDR Plus. So it was beating the iPhone 7. It was beating the brand new Galaxy S8. It was beating even, again, this $600 camera that, again, I love. And so it really did reinforce for me that computational photography is the great influence, is really the one of the biggest things you can add to any phone. That maybe the lens is not important, maybe the sensor isn't important, maybe even the onboard image processing isn't as important as just simply decide recognizing that, oh, that's a blue sky. People like blue skies to be blue. I will make that sky blue. So that's it's something to think about. I should qualify, though, before ending this, that my rules for when I take these photo walks is that I don't get to interact with the camera at all. I feel as though because different phones have different software features, the only fair way to do it is to keep it on completely automatic. So if the phone has the option of doing HDR, if it wants to do HDR, all I can do is just simply hold it up and press the shutter button. So obviously the difference between I would disagree with the idea that that means that this camera is just as good as the camera in my phone. The difference is that if I want to actually
this camera, is the cameras that Andy's recommended before, the Panasonic Lumix LX10.
Yeah, it's a little pocket camera.
Point and shoot.
I bought it when I was so impressed with the iPhone 7 last year, and so impressed with the Google Pixel phone that I thought maybe I should buy an iPhone 7 just as a walking around like pocket camera. And then said, "You idiot! An iPhone 7 will cost you $700. This you can buy a real camera with this actual optical zoom lens and a flash for that." But the point is that I think that the next real revolution is not going to be about, "Hey, look how big the sensor is," or "Hey, look at this wonderful exploded diagram of how intricate our lens system is." It's going to be, "Here is how much processing that we will do that's based not just simply on high exposure, low exposure, average them out, but at understanding that this is a picture of a statue. The statue is made out of bronze. Bronze has really, really deep shadow, hot, dark parts that have to be elevated out." So I just thought it was really weird that Kondotra was making that point, given that Android is probably the best.
Exactly. Had he not been so bitter about Google, I think he knows perfectly well that
there was a great
this
comment.
Is all done at Google, you know. Go ahead.
I don't remember who said it, but there was a great comment that said that previously it was all the algorithm guys that ruled this industry, and they would work on the pixels. It's just like, you know, separate the colors and find the edges. And now it's all the machine learning guys who have taken over this product at all the companies. Exactly. And they're trying to say, this is not brown. This is a mountain. This is not blue. This is a sky. It's not white. It's clouds. And this is what we know about these things. And they should look, this is the idealized way they should look. And they're doing exactly what Andy said. And I think the shift now is towards computational systems that can also ingest a lot of data, like why you're getting two lenses, or why you're maybe going to start getting those 3D sensors or laser arrays inside the cameras, so they can ingest as much information about the world as possible to make better choices, and then sort of recreate a reality inside the picture that's as good as it possibly can
and
be.
Credit to Mark Lavoy, who is at Google Research and is their head of computational photography. And he started doing this with the Jump camera, their VR camera, the Google Glass. He had some very challenging physical limitations, and they got better and better and better at handling it computationally to take kind of an imperfect optical shot and make it a much better shot. So you're right.
Scene detection instead of just face detection.
Exactly, just as Andy was talking about.
As a matter of fact, just I think it might have been just a couple of days before this came out, there was a new research paper that Google Research, working with MIT, was talking about an AI algorithm they had done where you teach the AI by saying, here are 5,000 pictures and here are 5,000 versions of that picture that have been edited by real human beings. And so that gives them that experience that a real human being, if they were fixing this, would sharpen this a little bit, but not a whole lot. They would increase the brightness, but not so much that there's a halo around the sun. And the idea, and on top of all that, it's not just a post-processing thing. The algorithm is built so that if it's on sufficiently good hardware, it'll actually just, this is the preview image you will get. You will get the optimized image in preview. So that's really is where things are going. Not just the mathematics that says that you can mathematically and procedurally look at the histogram. Like here is the chart of where all the light values are and realize that, okay, there's almost no black tones. There's almost no white tones. So let's make sure that there's a little bit more of a spread there. We're talking about, no, this is how a human being would want this to look like. So that's why.
And I should point out, this is not unique to Google and Apple. I mean, Sony and other companies are doing computational photography in their high-end cameras. Actually, that's where Nikon and Canon are being, I think, a little bit left behind. This is the Sony A9, where it's both it's hardware and software. They're providing amazing new stacked, you know, full-frame chips, but then they're also backing it up with computational photography. This is a picture I took. A lot of camera gear with me to Machu Picchu. This is a picture I took at Machu Picchu with my Google Pixel and HDR Plus turned on. It's one of the best pictures I took, and it was with a camera phone, not with my, you know, Canon 5D Mark IV. So I do think that Vic has a lot of merit in what Vic says. Bottom line, computational photography is the future, but I'm not throwing away my DSLR. Well, it's happening there, too.
Well, and I think that especially for landscape shots, the difference the DSLR and the phone drops dramatically.
Yeah.
You know, low light, it starts to show up. There is a certain amount of physics. You know, so one of the things Canon has done is they have what's called an ME20 video camera. And we have an ME200, which is kind of the smaller version of it.
It's interesting. Canon's really making most progress in video now, isn't it?
Yeah, they're doing a lot of interesting things with video. I mean, we only use them as, so we're pretty much a Blackmagic house at this point, except for these Canon cameras, which are extremely good at low light. The ME20 will pretty much, you can shoot at night.
Is that computational or that's just a big
chip? It's a mixture. They did two things. One is that they took a full size sensor.
Yeah.
And in ours is a Super 35, and they just said, okay, it's going to be 1920 by 1080. So it's, you know,
lots of area. So it's like very few pixels.
It's giant micron, you know, like giant sensors. Yeah. So each photo site is really big. And as a result, you know, the ISO goes to like 4 million, you know, and we worked on a show where there was a lot of these ME20s being used in at 2 a.m. you know, in Africa, you know, and we're getting these live feeds, and it just looks like, you know, it doesn't look like the sun, but it looks like it's, you know, early morning or whatever, and you can see all the color, you can see everything there. It was kind of amazing, you know. And the ME20s are about 20 grand, and the, you know, the ME200s are 5 grand, but they're still, you know, that is taking advantage of physics. And then they added, of course, on top of that, a ton of computational photography to pull that out. You know, it's not one or the other.
And admittedly, this is an order of magnitude more expensive than an iPhone 7 Plus. And probably isn't in order to
better. And it's not in your pocket all the time.
And it's not in my pocket.
That's the big thing.
But a serious photographer is going to carry a pocket camera like Andy and a bigger camera and maybe even a camera phone. And I think increasingly the kind of pro point and shoots that photographers bought are slowing down a little bit because a lot of
I mean, to me, there's,
I don't need that.
You have to, right. I think it's the difference between the people. There are a lot of people who would buy like a $500 Nikon SLR because there are types of shots that they wanted to take that would require that kind of a camera, not because they really wanted to be fancy schmancy photographers.
Right.
Now, the people who need an SLR, that's few and far between. I think there are advantages to having a nice camera, but You can get the promise, particularly of an iPhone. This is the one area in which I absolutely think that the iPhone is the best camera you can possibly get, is because no other phone camera is as good at the idea of, I'm going to aim this, I'm going to press this button, and it's going to give me a picture that will never be less than good. Remember that there's a factor of the software you've got on your phone itself or on your desktop, where Snapseed is just amazing. It's Google's free image processing app. There are times where I am home and I'm in Photoshop and Lightroom trying to reproduce the results I got just by twiddling it around in 5 or 10 minutes with Snapseed. And then there's the idea of there's a picture that I took in Harvard Square in like 1993, 1994 with one of my first digital cameras of a street performer who later on became a super, super famous performer, and she wanted to use this picture that I'd taken like in a TED talk she was giving. that went on to become a huge TED Talk. And I was is the first I've managed to find my original 2 or 3 megapixel JPEG, and by using modern apps for HDR, modern apps for removing noise, I was amazed at what I could do just in 30 seconds, 30 seconds and even 30 minutes to take a picture that had a huge number of defects, but then there's enough data inside there that a modern app could quickly tease out and figure out what the structure of this picture is and sort of intuit where I was trying to go, like what my intent was while I'm trying to improve it. So don't the bottom line is don't worry too much about what kind of a camera you're using.
I think you're right. As long as you got enough data, you can do something with it. This is a Red.
Always save the originals.
The folks who did the Red camera announced this crazy $1,500.
It's $1,500 for the titanium, I think.
Hydrogen One phone. But it won't be out till next year. Would anybody?
Because of course they did.
Yeah, because of course.
Who would buy that? Who would be crazy enough?
You. You would buy it. You know that.
I was on the list.
You were on the list instantly.
In the first 10 seconds. I was like,
really?
I was like, I don't even know what it does. I'm buying it.
If it's a phone and it's from Red, I'm getting it. Oh, Marcus Brownlee's reviewing it here.
He still, I think, wasn't allowed to show it. Like, none of us really know what it is. Like, it's like it does something great, and we don't. And Red is one of the few companies like Apple.
He wasn't allowed to show the holographic display, right?
That was it's got a holographic display.
Oh, who cares about that, right? It's kind of, well, it's. I think it's kind of ugly.
It looks like a droid.
It's something you'd want, though, right? It's kind of.
I still fit it in my pocket. There didn't seem to be
I like the industrial look of it.
Obviously, yeah. This will turn into a two-handed phone for a lot of people. And then the camera bump on the back.
Look at the size of that bump.
Placeholder than an indicator of what the module will actually look like on the inside, but it's still pretty big.
Definitely it's larger.
So it's too early. In other words,
They showed him 2 or 3 models. One is just, right. Here is the design prototype. One that was functional, it looked nothing like the design prototype.
Right.
And then I think there was a mystery device that had the holographic stuff working on it. But that's interesting. It does point out that there are so many people for whom it really isn't a case of getting good pictures. They are videographers, they are journalists, and this is the device that they carry into a situation, because who wants to carry 80 pounds worth of stuff if you can buy something, if for $500 you can get something that will give you the video that you need, give you the mobility you need, give you the height ability that you need.
So did they take your money already, or did they just?
I had to get them some. I had to give them
some money. It says,
yeah, I had
it's $15.95 for the titanium, and you could just get like aluminum for $11.95. But who would
save
want,
a few by now? Yeah,
who would want that? Let me just see if they want money. Order now.
I don't think I had to put money down. I think I just got on the list.
I'm just glad to
see a physical phone design that's at least interesting. That's not a, hey, look, for 2017, the rounded rectangle, the radius is a little bit larger than it was the last time, but it's still a rounded rectangle. Okay.
I think I gave the credit card, and I think that means that, you know, I won't get charged, but as soon as I get charged, that'll be the time that I have to explain to my wife.
Yeah. You got a little pass.
What is this order for? Did you buy another camera? No, of course not. I didn't buy another camera.
It probably, the thing is, why make it a phone at all?
Oh, because it gives you, if it's,
you want data.
Yeah. I mean, you can get the data. You can, you know, it replaces something. You can now go out with only that and shoot it. I think it makes a lot of sense.
And you look like a badass, Leo.
It can hardly be overstated how this is a legitimate journalistic tool now.
That's true. We were in the ability.
It really is like, remember the Max Headroom TV show, like from the 1980s, where Edison Carter has like this big Sony Betacam that has this miraculous antenna that can actually broadcast from wherever he is, and now we've actually got it. There are people that it's not enough for me to record this video. I have to make sure that this video leaves this device and goes someplace safe before people with clubs discover that I'm not simply a tourist. I'm someone who's won a Pulitzer.
We were in Switzerland at a big event, and like half the journalists were just running around with iPhones. They were out there shooting their streaming to
even
Facebook
for
Live.
Video.
And,
I mean,
well, shoot streaming to Facebook Live, and especially you take one of those iPhones and you put it onto the Osmo mobile.
Yeah.
And you're sitting there running around, and it's got a gimbal, and so you're running around and doing these interviews. And we've built some pretty complex rigs for the iPhone. So you can get XLR in, wireless. You hook your wireless to it. You got lights and
you're like the little thing you hold it. But you're just nuts.
It's like,
he's got a Canon ME and an iPhone.
An iPhone, and here's the funny thing: my iPhone rig costs more than the Canon ME200. You know, but it's like, you know, you can basically build all of this stuff into it with the right, you know, bits and pieces of it. And
I got the Osmo. Should I use that to like?
One of the coolest things to do with the Osmo, and I have kind of all of the Osmos. So, one of the cooler things to do with an Osmo is take it. If you have a sunroof, just take it and hang it out the sunroof. Now you have to kind of push up against it. Now you can also now get we got these little suction cups for it, it's like you're floating through a town. I was in Cambodia and just stuck it out the top, and it was like floating through these little villages. It's just amazing. That's the little one. I think that's the original
one. I have the handheld one.
There's that one, and then there's one that's got the Zenmoose 5, I think, on it. That's a bigger version of that. Oh. And then there's the iPhone one, and then they've got a bunch of different versions, because there's one that's like the Osmo Pro, I think.
Oh yeah, this one has a built-in camera, but then I got the one that has the one that doesn't have a camera because you just put your iPhone on it.
Right. I have, and that's the one I kind of throw in my bag. I mean, I don't carry this one around that much. I use that one for shooting other things.
Yeah.
So, and the other thing is that with the Pro one, you can take that off and put it on the bottom of like a Inspire.
It's from the same company. It's the DJI Phantom company.
And I think somehow we've accumulated most of what DJI makes. So we kind of are playing with
shocked.
Those. I was flying the Mavic. I have the Mavic.
Can you mount the robot arm on the drone and then fly the phone around?
This
is the one I got, the Osmo Mobile.
Probably. The only bummer about it is you can't plug in the lightning goes, the lightning's on the wrong side. Like you want to be able to have it. And so the bummer about that is that you
can't power it while you're using it.
Well, power is one thing, but the other thing is when we want to stream from an iPhone we hook it to Ethernet.
Yeah.
So then we have super solid.
Can't put it in upside down?
Yeah. Because Ethernet's the way to go. Still the way to go when you're streaming.
You can't put the camera in upside down? So a phone in upside down, Alex?
No, you can do it upside down.
You can?
Okay. The Osmo, yeah, absolutely. You can rig it. You can rig it right side up or upside down.
The lightning port's still covered though.
You have to mount it.
Too bad.
It does go in that way.
That is a weird choice, isn't it? I don't know why
probably to keep people from us doing that, because it probably would be bad for the gimbal.
Yeah.
That's probably why they did it. But it's still annoying.
Oh, because you have something attached. You don't want to attach anything.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah, they should give you a lightning out.
At the bottom of the gimbal or something, maybe, like, you know, like that.
Yeah, I mean, and you can try to. And the hard part is just, you know, Wi-Fi is not a very, you know, it's not a great solution.
So let's talk about.
Sorry.
Alex just makes me spend money, that's all. Let's talk about iOS 11 helps you shoot photos straight from the heart. This is Rene Ritchie's long piece that he did. This is why he wasn't here last week. About how iOS 11 is going to change how camera works on iPhone 7 or any iPhone, right? So what's going to be new in iOS 11?
So, I mean, there's part of it that's new just for the iPhone 7 Plus and for whatever other dual camera systems Apple puts out this fall, and that is the portrait mode has gotten a lot more powerful. Previously, it was tuned mostly for facial recognition, and you could get away with shooting things like coffee, which I kept doing, but you know, it wasn't perfect, and it had trouble with some reflections and angles and things, and now it does a much better job. It's tuned for flowers. Even I did a shot of a fence there where it picks up the fence and then blurs everything behind the fence. So it's gotten much more sophisticated in what it can do. And one of the really cool things is with Apple's new HEIF, the high efficiency image format, is it keeps the depth data separate. It doesn't burn it in anymore into the image.
They're replacing JPEG with HEIF.
Yes.
H-E-I-F. Which is like,
it's like the H.265 version of JPEG.
So it's more compact than JPEG?
And it does take slightly longer to process, but for video, that's more of a deal than it is for images. Images are still lightning fast, and it gives you better compression, but mostly it bundles things together. So instead of having live photos that have a separate JPEG and movie file, it's just the data is there together. Instead of having a copy of the depth photo where the depth is burned in and a regular, you have a photo that has the depth data. So you can get the blur effect, but also a filter, for example, could apply things based on the depth data, like the new Silvertone filter in iOS 11. It will change the way it processes processes the filter based on the depth data contained in the
photo.
Here's
an example you took of, are these your nieces of two?
My godkids.
So yeah. there's a difference in contrast even from the foreground and the background.
Yeah, and that's, they're calling it the Depthy API. So that's available to developers too, so they can start doing things with the different depth data.
Isn't that interesting? And, I don't. You'd have to use regions in Lightroom to do this. This would be a significant amount of time to make it look like this. That's a very interesting effect, and I like it. I think it's a really effect.
It's one of the things that get from having a format, so you can pull these photos over to your Mac or to your iPad and completely change the way the depth is being.
So HEIF is a standard.
Yes,
but no one supports it.
No, and there's Apple. API. So the hope is that, you know, like with a lot of these things, that the adoption will. I mean, we're still using GIF from the CompuServe days.
So what you would do is you would capture it in HEIF, process it on the iPhone, and export a JPEG for posting on Instagram or anywhere else.
There's some hope that Adobe and other companies will support it, like even do things like turn it into an alpha layer so that you can do a lot of different things with it.
Ooh, that would be interesting.
Using that, I mean, we were talking a little bit about this, but using that grayscale, whether it's in compositing in After Effects or Photoshop, there's a lot of filters that can take advantage of a grayscale image that's giving you depth information for either. There's actually, I think when you do the lens blur in Photoshop, it already asks you. I mean, there's a drop down that says, give me a black and white that gives me the depth, and I can, you know, do that. So there's a bunch of options there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then for live photos, it's one of those things. It's almost Microsoftian, you know, when they put out something that nobody really understands, and then it gets better and better and better over the years. And live photos is sort of like that now, because it's not just you take a photo and you get a little bit of animation on each side. They've made live photos a lot better, where you have, again, that single container, but it also, the quality is so high now that you can choose any frame as the keyframe, and you can crop them and you can edit them. And this has a bunch of fun effects, almost like Instagram, but you're not bound to the social network.
Boomerang-y, yeah.
Yeah, this is bounce. They're calling it bounce because I guess Boomerang was taken. So this just, you know, it goes in and out, and there's fade and there's loop, and it does long exposure too. So if you're doing a different, so if you're taking traffic going by or light streaming by, you can press the long exposure button and it'll pull it out and motion blur.
Is this in the camera app itself?
In the camera app and the photos app, because they're sort of blended a little bit together. So you just swipe up on the photo that you've just taken, and you can add all these effects to it. And it's based on the same live photo data, and it stays editable. So this is the loop filter
we're looking at, which is, how is this different than the bounce filter? Oh, it's just going.
It's a loop. It goes in a certain, the bounce. I'm switching between the two there because it, again, it's non-destructive. So you can have it bouncing and say, no, I don't really like it. I want to make it a loop. And yeah, you can do these things in Instagram, for example, or you could do these in Snapchat, but then you're stuck in that platform. And if you want to send it to, you know, Uncle Bill, who doesn't use social networks, it's a real process to get it out. Where with this, it's just, it will send it as a live photo to anyone on iOS, and it will burn it out as a animated GIF to anybody not on iOS. So you can just share it over messages. You can even drop the file to somebody if you want to. So it just gives you the ability to quickly make
this is a step forward in portrait. This is called,
is live photo.
No, I'm looking at grid now.
Oh, yeah, those, yeah.
So tell me about this. What's going on here?
So now that, if you scroll down, there's also a really cute little feature that they've got in there. Sorry, it's a little bit higher up. Okay. Where they have a level. Did I put it in there? I think it's in there somewhere. I might have forgot to put it in there. But there's a new feature. There's a level in the iOS camera app now, where if you move the camera so you're shooting straight down or straight up, it superimposes a cross mark. Hatch marks, and then you can put those over top of each other, and it makes sure that the photo is level. So your brunch looks perfect, or your dramatic upshot of the building looks spot on.
So they just fade in. It fixes the tilt, or?
Yeah, it fades in, and then you can make sure it's tilted perfectly to get the exact downward shot, not on an angle, and then it fades out again. And it only works if you have the grid on, because they sort of feel that people who are obsessed enough to have a grid on really care about that sort of thing, and they won't bug you with
perfect
extra data.
They're exactly right. Yeah, if you're using a grid, you'd want to know that. So HEIF is a standard. It's an ISO standard. It's MPEG. It's just not widely supported yet, but it makes sense that Apple should push this forward, because it gives you a lot more information.
It should be a lot more of a standard when there's 70 million phones that are
To me, the big deal is just the fact that it's a container, because now there's so much data that's being collected that, like, even when I'm taking pictures with, again, my old-timey Lumix camera here, it's like, okay, so there's a JPEG, there is also a RAW picture, there is also, for video, there's also another sidecar file that has been written for another piece of software to pick up. It'd be nice if, as computational photography is being provided with so much different pieces of information, if a phone can be empowered to say, you know what, we're going to write to this file every single scrap of data we use per ourselves internally to build this JPEG so that a more sophisticated app today or 10 years from now can exploit that exact same information to make this phone, this picture even better, because a JPEG is a JPEG is a JPEG. But a JPEG with raw data plus depth information, that's cool stuff in 2019.
Yeah, when you're using a JPEG, what you've basically said is to the software or the camera, all right, you make the decisions about exposure and everything. Create a burned image that is fixed and export that. Mm-hmm. But it's very hard. You can't do much to that JPEG. You've lost everything but that actual image as developed. In effect, you're getting a developed image in that.
Yeah.
But with the HEIF format, you've still got all the data. You've got a render, the JPEG render, but you also got the data that contributed to the render, so you could change your mind, in other words.
Well, and I think that one of the pressures that's going to be applied to most of the other software manufacturers to support it is that Apple does have its own photo software that's going to take advantage of that.
Right.
You know, so as right. as you start to have photos, being able to change depth or some people are going to be going like, well, I don't want to take it into Lightroom because I don't have enough control. You know, I mean, that's the danger that Adobe has if they don't support the format. So I have a feeling that we're going to see the format get supported within 12 months.
Is this image the chain link fence image, Renee? Is this an example of portrait mode?
Yeah.
So in the past, portrait had to have a human face, or if you were lucky, your dog.
It was optimized for it. Yeah, it was optimized for that. It had a great deal of difficulty. And so what they've done now is, again, it understands more scenes than it did before. It understands more objects than it did before. And also it can go to lower light levels than it could before. And it'll even work with a flash now. So they're just trying to make portrait mode work in a far wider range of circumstances.
So this is, I would say, an extraordinarily tough image, which is a focus is on the chain link fence. Now, in truth, the actual image, the camera phone picked up probably had everything in focus. It's probably a very high, aperture was very closed down, very high aperture. But what it did, it was able to use the depth information to defocus the back plane, keep the front plane in focus, and to do it almost perfect. I don't see any flaws in this.
And I don't think, I mean, smooth edges are one of the easier things to do. Doing something like that in front of a, is something that we always want to do. And some of the earlier photos that are in Renee's article, I think, actually show much better hair resolution than we've seen in the past.
Here's an example.
It's a little soft, but it's there. You know, it's probably missing a little bit of it.
There's some problems, but
You don't know. I mean, it could be out of focus.
But I'm zoomed way in.
Yeah, I don't think that would be as problematic as I've seen the portrait mode be.
Yeah.
So I think that there's definitely some improvements going on there.
And the thing with the chain link fence is not so much that it's a smooth surface, but that it recognizes the chain link fence and doesn't try to find a face to lock onto for portrait mode.
Right. It didn't get fooled.
And I believe that, I mean, I'm not totally certain, but I believe that a lot of that has to do with, you know, basically what you're seeing in that live photo is small movements in the camera's position, even micro movements in that camera position allows it with the two lenses allows it to look at parallax and make a decision about what's close and what's far away.
Yeah,
and it's interesting too because now with a lot of those filters, it also does image stabilization. So when you're doing the live photo, and then you tell it to do a loop or you tell it to do a motion blur, it'll lock on everything that's not moving, stabilize that, and that makes the loop or the bounce or the long exposure even more evident, like water flowing or hair, twirling, those sorts of things. So it's neat stuff.
So I am now really excited about getting the new iPhone. Between AR and...
Oh, I think it's going to be big.
And that camera system is going to, like, you know, by all indications, the camera system on there is going to be another big step forward.
This by itself would be enough.
I think that the issue is that for the camera manufacturers, the hard part about this is just the trajectory of, you know, they're doing the best they can in a somewhat constrained, you know, a market that's actually getting smaller. Their little island is getting smaller. Revenue is getting smaller. And you have... not just Apple, but Apple and Google and a lot of other folks that they're spending. I mean, the phone is, remember, the phone being able to take great photos is a huge part of why we buy a new upgrade.
Right.
And so, I mean, I heard that's the number exactly was 200 or 250, you know, engineers that are just working on the camera for Apple. And it's just hard when Apple's going to throw the amount of money at this problem that Canon makes every you know, Canada makes every year. You know, that's the real challenge for camera manufacturers is that it's just an enormous amount of energy being put into computational photography.
And they're a computer company doing it, which means they have a lot of the in-house talent to really handle the edge cases. And
they know how to make interfaces.
And while Google does control the Pixel phone and probably will make a very exciting Pixel phone this year, most Android phones are not made by Google, which means they don't control the hardware.
That's hard.
You know, Samsung does its own camera thing, which is quite good, quite capable, but it's different.
Right.
Well, that's why that they have their camera app that can be installed on individual Android phones. That's why they're selling the strength of their camera system as being the Google Assistant. So that once we can't control how you take that picture, but believe me, once you get that picture on our servers, we're going to drift back down a much better version of it than your crummy little blister pack CVS pharmacy phone was able to take.
Actually, Renee makes that point right at the beginning of his article that Google has to do it server side. Apple can do it because they control the hardware on the phone. I'm excited. I can't wait. We're gonna know soon enough. It's likelihood a month away.
Yeah, it's amazing how fast it's going. Whew,
that's called life.
Yeah.
It gets faster as you get farther down the slide.
Every year is a smaller part of your life.
Oh, is that why? That makes sense.
Yeah,
every year is now only 1/60th of my life.
Yeah, before it was half your life, and then it was a third of your life.
Oh, you're right.
No, but I'm super excited. And like Andy's point previously, the competition just makes them all better because it is such a big selling feature that everyone talks about the power of the camera, and everyone has to race to keep up with that.
Yeah, yeah. Let's take a break. When we come back, your picks of the week, fellas, you're up for that?
I'm ready.
Sure.
Let's get going. I want to congratulate Texture. Texture is the app of the day today. On the new iOS 11 App Store. If you don't have iOS 11, I don't know if they still do that on iOS 10. Do they, Renee? The new App Store is great. It's got all these picks and, you know, it's got little kits and all sorts of stuff. I really like that.
It'll be updated more frequently when it's out of beta.
Yeah, yeah. But this today, Texture is the app of the day, and rightly so. Texture is amazing. Think of Texture. I think the easiest way to describe it is Texture is Netflix for magazines. So there are hundreds of great magazines out there. And if you were to subscribe to them all, well, it just costs you a ton. But what if instead of subscribing to every magazine, or gosh, it'd be even worse if you went out and bought them all, right? What if you had every magazine possible available to you and you just got to read them on your iPad? Well, that's what Texture is. More than 200 of the best magazines, everything. At this point, I don't know what magazines aren't on Texture, but everything I want to read. Look at this. This is the list. Everything from ARP, the magazine, to Yoga Journal, and everything in between. Backpacker, Canadian Cycling, Canadian Running, CBS Soaps in Depth, Oprah, the Oprah magazine, Teen Vogue, Regular Vogue, Vanity Fair. There is an article every month I want to read in Vanity Fair. It's on there. It's on there. And the thing is, when you subscribe to Texture, it's $10 a month. You get access to any of these magazines. You favorite the magazines you know you want all the time. I get National Geographic. That's absolutely when I automatically download. One of the reasons I love it is National Geographic's images. In fact, any magazine with great pictures are better on the iPad than they are in print. They don't have to be screened. You get kind of the digital image, which is amazing. Plus, you get features in magazines you can't get in print, like video. There's curated picks, so if you don't know what to read. Look at all the computer magazines. PC Magazine, PC World, Popular Mechanics, Popular Science, Shutterbug. Love that magazine. And Wired, I read that. There's always something I want to read in Wired. Sound and Vision for you audio geeks. The thing is, you may not subscribe to Billboard. That's expensive, or Variety, or Ad Age, or Sound and Vision. But you don't have to. With Texture, you've got the entire issue, every page, including the ads. It's the whole thing. Fit Pregnancy and Baby magazine, Girls Life, Boys Life. Every once in a while, I want to read Boys Life and go back to my youth. And it's so much fun. Road and Track, Golfers, Golf Magazine, Golf Tips, Men's Journal, Men's Health, Reminisce, Cruising the Classics. I tell you what, here we go. We got a 2-week free trial for you right now. If you go to texture.com/tweet, you don't have to take my word for it. But I should warn you, as soon as you sign up and download the Texture app and put it on your phone or your tablet, you're going to say, oh, I can't live without this. And if you travel, if you're going away this summer, why bring a stack of magazines to the beach? Just bring your tablet, and you've got them all. Texture.com/Twit, one of Apple's top 2016 iPads. And today, it's the pick of the day on the new iOS 11 App Store, and rightly so. Texture.com/Twit. Try it today. Time for the picks of the week. I think we've got to give you, Alex Lindsay, the pride of place here since we rarely get to see you in studio. Did you bring some? By the way, this is you picked this wallet case. We should show this. You picked that a couple of weeks ago, and it really, yeah, don't show your credit cards, but
it's
nice looking. It's got a nice leather. It's like really, little, it's worn like a good wallet.
Yeah, there we go.
Gets a little bit worn.
Yeah, it's a little, you know, it's definitely worn for wear on the side.
I'm going to get that.
But it's great. And
I'm going to wait till the new iPhone comes
out. It does limit. It doesn't shut quite right if you put too much in it.
Yeah,
so
mine
constantly.
Never did. Yeah.
No, there's a certain number of cards that I can keep in, which
right.
is plenty.
Right.
The thing is, I never misplace my phone or my wallet because one or the other, I lose them together. I need both of them too often to make it work. So it's good.
Anyway, that was a pick in the previous life. What
still
do you have for us today?
So in my house, you know, I had some dead spots for Wi-Fi. And I was, you know, and we've got this crazy Sonos system. There's like a whole bunch of Sonoses that weren't.
Sonoses and Wi-Fi, they will kill Wi-Fi fast.
Well, and I wired them partially, you know, so there's
you can do that. You can have a base station.
They're really, they're amazing. You update one and they just go whoop. You know, but
I just did that.
Yeah, and so the and there's like, you know, there's a lot in the house anyway. So but getting the Wi-Fi working, getting it working for the phones, getting it working for my Amazon, you know, in different rooms. You know, I have the Amazon thing that I won't say.
Yeah,
and then I'm also testing. We're testing the Google Home, so we have, you know, all of those things kind of floating around, and they were all having trouble, and they were all not quite working. So I decided I just got to solve this, and so I wanted something that could have a little bit more control than just a, you know, regular Wi-Fi setup. So I got Ubiquiti's Amplify.
Oh, interesting.
So we're using heavier versions of Ubiquiti for other things.
It's the enterprise solution. It's a really good solution for
that. Yeah, I mean, and at the office we use a lot of Meraki systems, but the
actually I think Megan's got my Amplify. If somebody wants to go get it.
Right, and so this is what you do is you hook your hub up.
You got the HD, not the you got the there's two of them.
I got the one that's showing right here.
Get the one that, well, they both look like that, but you want to get the one that's tri-band. There's a dual band.
I did get a tri-band.
Yeah, get the good one.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a little more expensive, but it's worth it.
Yeah, so I put that in there, and I've been really happy with it. It's a little bit more setup than I expected. I did have to call Comcast and work through.
Really?
Yeah, it wouldn't show up. They had to reset something on their end to make that work. Now, admittedly, I also changed the modem, you know, a day before, so that might have been part of it. But it once I got that sorted out, setting up the access points and just setting up the little, and it builds a mesh.
Those plug into the wall, which is nice.
And so you find kind of discrete places to put them. The nice thing about it is that there isn't, it's a mesh, so if it can't see the host, it's a little bit slower, but it works. And so so you just kind of plug it in. You see it on your iPhone. You interconnect it.
I think they're really good looking, too. I really have
nice.
To say. Once you plug it in, you've got the readout on the front.
And then it forms a router on the back. So if you look at it on the back, you've got a couple outputs to do the routing on it. And what you can do is you can also set up multiple networks. And what's nice about it is you can set up guest networks. So someone's coming over, you can set up a guest network just for them. It's kind of funny. You can say, you know, like,
oh yeah,
like, you know, so when they come in and they look at their phone, it'll be like Richard's Wi-Fi.
Use this, Richard.
You know,
the password is,
you know, but it's only open for like 3 hours,
right?
You know, and so while they're there, they have Wi-Fi, and it's not on your, you know, it's its own SSID, and so I think it works. It's not the same as. You know, people try to compare it to the professional version, and there's a lot of things the professional version does. But when you look at it on its own, but this was relatively easy to. Once I got it up, you just keep on adding points as you need them, and so I've got like four points in the base station in my house, and now everything is. It went from being rocky to smooth without a lot of work.
These are the satellite units, and you plug them into the wall, and then you can. What's nice is you can aim them.
Yeah.
But I got scared because one day I knocked this off.
Right.
But it's just a magnet.
Yeah, you just pop it right back in. It's like the Nest outdoor.
I love that. Yeah, like the Nest outdoor.
Yeah. So anyway, it works. It works well, and it, you know, it over time gets. You know, it took about a half an hour for it to like kind of
I restarted it. I was doing something else, and suddenly it really built the mesh out really nicely.
That's one thing that does happen with all of these solutions. They get better over time. They get smarter over time.
Yeah.
And how many of the base? How many of the?
I put four in.
Four. Yeah.
Put one in my wife's office to make sure she was getting strong Wi-Fi. The house has. I could have gotten away with other things. My house has Cat 5 in almost every major room, so it's not.
I'm so jealous.
So I still Cat 5 at the thing, but right. Just having my phones and everything else.
That's one thing that this doesn't do that both the Eero and the Plume do. They have Ethernets on all the satellites, and if you have Ethernet jacks in that room, you can connect them, and it builds an even stronger network because it's got an Ethernet backhaul.
And I thought about it, and I just realized I just want to plug it in. We're building larger meshes with their professional line where you're doing PoE that powers them and gives them Ethernet and so on and so forth.
I think,
but anyway, I was pretty happy with it.
We've used Ubiquiti. I think we're using Ruckus today, but
Ruckus are good too. Yeah. Ruckus are very good too.
The Amplify, and it turns out they don't sell the other one anymore. I guess the HD is the one they sell at Amplify.com, AMPLIFI.com, home Wi-Fi. And I'll tell you, I wish you'd told me because this one's just been sitting around here because I bought it for testing, but nobody seems to want it.
We'll see.
We'll fix that, Leo.
I have them all. I use them all. At home, I have the new Eeros, who are our sponsor, and I have Plumes because I have two networks, and I use them all.
In my office, I also have a Meraki because that ties me into the
exactly.
office.
Forget a mesh. You have a Weave network.
They're different. It's different uses for different use cases, but there you go. Your Amplify. And that's not even an Alex. It's half an Alex.
I'm afraid I have a phone call that I thought this was a safe time to schedule it.
See you later. Thank you, Alex Lindsay.
Thanks, guys.
We'll
see you guys. Yeah.
Renee Ritchie, your pick of the week.
So I have two really quick picks because I was talking a lot about photography this week. I was playing with some more photo apps, and one of them is a really nice indie app by Ben Rice called Obscura. It's a camera app. One of the things Apple hasn't done and won't do is put a lot of fussy manual controls in their camera app. It's meant for what exactly Andy said earlier in the show. It's that you just want to pick up the phone, take a photo, and get a really good result and not have to worry about it or fuss with it too much. So what they've done is create a lot of APIs for developers. It lets them do things like pull out the high dynamic range data, the high color data, the DCI-P3 data, the raw camera data, and then developers can make apps that let you tweak exposure or focus or all these different things. And Obscura is one of those, and it's a really nice design. Ben is sort of really well known because he photographs a lot of the Apple conferences like UL, and he used to do Singleton, and he takes really, really nice photos, and he sort of built his dream camera app out of this. So it gives you a lot of control and a lot of power over what you do with the iPhone camera, but it's still in an interface that's very simple and very accessible. So if you want to take the plunge, if you want to go beyond Apple's built-in camera app, but you don't want to go into something really complicated, I'd recommend Obscura. It's just a really nice way to get your feet wet with manual controls and with raw data and things like that. And the second one is at the opposite end of the spectrum, and this is a huge mega company, Adobe. They're doing a better job, and they haven't brought full-on Photoshop to the iPad, which a lot of people would still like them to do, but they have brought Lightroom to the iPad, and it's fairly good. It's not exactly Lightroom, as you know and love on the desktop, but it's Lightroom that can do a lot of things. I would say the interface is more challenging, and again, Adobe has a really hard and complex problem to solve on an iPad, it is a little bit harder to learn. The learning curve is a little bit steeper, but you get access if you're already, especially if you're a Creative Cloud subscriber, you have access to your library, you have access to all your photos, and if you are on the go, if you're winding down, if you have your feet up, if you're in the coffee shop and you just want to take those photos that you've shot, and maybe you've worked on them on your desktop or you've taken them with your phone or you've taken them with a camera and uploaded them earlier, you can just pull those onto your iPad and do like a gradient mask and play around with make the stars look just the way you like it, or bring out all the detail in the ground that's below the bright, bright sky and make the photo look more like what you remember it looking like. And while it is complicated, it's still super fast. And I find I can get results using it in a few minutes that I'd probably, I won't say waste, but spend a lot more time on the desktop trying to emulate. So two very different apps, but both really great for someone who wants to do more photography.
And we should mention that Obscura is free.
Yeah.
That kind of blows me away that he gives this away for free.
I wish he would charge a lot of. I mean, I believe he started off charging a lot for it, but it's a hard market.
Yeah. So Apple does give the app access to the raw data.
Yeah, they have APIs for almost everything, and now they're going to have APIs for the depth data. They have APIs for the raw data. They have APIs for exposure and for Focus and for ISO. I mean, just almost anything you can think of, they're giving you an API for it these days.
I wonder if Ben will start charging, say, you know, free for the iPhone 7 version, but if you wanted the iPhone 8 version, start charging
I'm
for that.
I'm almost sure. I didn't know it was free because I'm pretty sure it was paid initially.
It's $4.99 here.
Oh, I must have bought it then.
Because, because I thought
I must have bought it before because it didn't cost me anything to download it. Well, $4.99 is a good deal.
That's still a steal. Yeah, I'm glad he is charging for it. I would have had to DM him right after the show if not.
Say, yeah, really. thank you, Andy. I must have bought this once before.
I wish that the app store would fix that, because sometimes you want to recommend an app to somebody, or sometimes you want to buy, you want to get an app to somebody, but you don't know.
We have that problem on iOS today all the time. I have to ask the TD to not buy it and tell
them. I have to find the non-Canadian.
That's another thing. And by the way, once again, my pick of the week, go to headlines.com and get the Justin Trudeau bare-chested Canada
t-shirt.
What are those? Canadian geese in the setting sun?
Yeah.
A polar bear and Serenity Caldwell.
The Rockies.
The Rockies.
And 100% pure Trudeau.
I like that. Andy Inoko, your pick of the week.
don't forget that macOS has really great scripting options and automation. And if you are not aware of that, Take Control Books has a really good book. Joe Kissel has just updated his Take Control of Automating Your Mac to the second edition. It's $15, but it'll walk you through all the different ways that you can take processes that take multiple steps on your Mac and have it just triggered by a script, or not even have to trigger it at all. You just simply have a folder where if things land in the folder, then magical things start to happen. It also covers things like all the way from AppleScript Automator to Shell scripts to, I think that it even goes to certain things you can do on iOS, things you can do with Siri, macros, and Microsoft Office. Really, you have no idea how much time you're wasting on your Mac that is not related to Twitter or Instagram until you read a book like this and you realize that with maybe a couple of hours of effort maximum, you could take something that you always have to do that sucks 15 minutes each and every time and turn it into just a simple menu or a simple thing you double click on and it automatically works. I really wish that Apple would spend a lot more time promoting Automator and AppleScript and the automation features, because it's not as though you can't automate things on Linux or Windows, but I don't think that either of those have the same kind of consumer-friendly, user-friendly tools for doing that sort of stuff. $15, go to takecontrolbooks.com. And another quick plug that if you are in the San Francisco Bay Area, in Santa Clara, California, tomorrow is the Command D Masters of Automation Conference, where Sal Segoyan and Naomi and Paul Kent have put together an entire day-long conference all about automation solutions on macOS and on iOS. It's being sponsored by the Omni Group, that is as well invested in automation as pretty much more than any other company these days. And it's great people to hang out with. It's their first year of doing this, and it's one of the people organizing this is Paul Kent, of course, who used to organize nothing less than Mac World Expo every single year. You can feel like this is going to be the ground floor of, I think, something that's going to be really, really cool. I hope to be there next year, because it just looks just super, super cool. But it does start tomorrow, but you can go to, through the site, cmddconf.com. I should have a talk with them about URLs, but cmddconf.com. You can sign up through Eventbrite and be there tomorrow and hang out with some cool people and learn some cool stuff.
I'm so glad you plugged that, because I wanted to do that last week and I forgot. So yeah, it is tomorrow at the Hilton Santa Clara in Santa Clara, California. Absolutely awesome. Ladies and gentlemen, our time has come to say goodbye to all the family. We already said goodbye to Alex Lindsay, but let's not forget Andy Inoko. He's at the Chicago Sun-Times. His website, CWOB.com. His Flickr account, if you want to see his amazing images, is Andy I. He's on the Twitter, IHNATKO. I have no idea how to spell it. IHNATKO. And we will see you again next week. I hope you feel better.
Me too. Thank you.
Go to your favorite diner and have a bowl of matzo ball soup.
That's on the plan for tomorrow.
If you don't feel better, you'll at least be well fed.
We're sending Andy Power the Kryptonian sun.
There he is, master of the power of the Kryptonian sun, Mr. Renee Nitch Ritchie at imore.com. Read his great article on iOS 11 photography at imore.com. And, of course, his podcasts are there and lots more. And he does a great podcast, too, at relay.fm, Anako's Almanac. Thank you for being here for our podcast, Mac Break Weekly. We do it every Tuesday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC. If you want to be in the studio audience as our visitor from the U.K., he's traveling all over the United States. He's seeing all the highlights, Yosemite. He's seeing New York City, San Francisco, and for some reason he included us in that. Thank you for being here. All you have to do is email tickets at twit.tv. We'll put a seat out for you. If you want to watch on the stream, it's twit.tv/live. But if you do that, please join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. Be part of the fun group, the kids in the back of the class, the wiseacres. You can also get on-demand versions of everything we do at our website, twit.tv, in this case, twit.tv/mbw. And you can also subscribe. We have a subscribe page. It explains it. But if really the easiest thing to do is get that program, whatever it is you listen to podcasts with, and search for Mac Break Weekly and subscribe, and you'll have an episode in your inbox every Tuesday afternoon. Thanks for being here. And we'll see you next time. Now get back to work, because you know what? Break time is over.